members, the delegation from the department, the staff of the committee, and interested members of the public and the guests. I know that there is something called time, which in most cases is an enemy of progress. We tried our level best to see whether we can wait as much for honorable members. So let me apologize for those who have not arrived, for starting late, but earlier before they could arrive. I'm sure they'll accept our apologies. But having said so, when we started at the beginning of the year, we said that we initially had an interest to understand what is happening in the department, what are the challenges, what are the issues that probably we might need to know of. There's something I always say, it was not an investigation so that people can relax. We just wanted to know what's happening. And we said, as soon as we have a sense, we will then be able to know what to prioritize, what is it that we would need to deal with. And on the basis of that, that is why we are here today. Based on what we have received as an information, but also on what we think are areas that we need more details in dealing with. So that is the main purpose. But without going any further, are there any apologies?
Good morning, everyone. I've got apology from Mr. Kula and Mr. Zungula. They are running late. They will join us at 10, and Mr. Nomalo will not join us for this meeting. He's out of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I hope he's not a tourist. It's a very good one. Oh, there is a standing apology for Honorable Vulmaran. Okay, having said so, honorable members, we have the department with us today and the entity, specifically SEF. It's a contingent of two DGs. At least I compete much better. I've got two secretaries, I always say that. So the department can give as much as things, and we can take as much as we can. Okay. DG Zulu and DG Mukwena, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honorable Chairperson.
Chair, maybe before that, Chair, greetings to you, Chair, members of the committee and the department and our guests. I just feel like I should say this, Chair, before we proceed, so that the day I say it openly, people don't look at me like I'm a mad person. I have noticed, Chair, that our guests sometimes find themselves participating through gestures, and all sorts of things, and they know themselves. I just want to make a call, Chair, that as much as they are welcome, they are representing various interests, which is allowed. They should cease the temptation to participate where we participate, because if I say things you don't like, you don't have to nod or make gestures that indicate that you don't like it. It's not for you to like it in the first place. And I'm saying this without pointing at a person, but if it happens again, Chair, I want to warn that I will confront that person. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let me just say this. I'm sure those who usually go and attend the proceedings of Parliament, unfortunately, I've not been empowered to preside over the proceedings of Parliament. I sometimes say to preside over the proceedings of Parliament, you must also have attended some early childhood development course so that you can manage what is happening inside. It has not happened to that extent in the committee. But let me say it is, and I always emphasize this thing, when we visited the entities, I had to also explain. Meetings of the committee are accessible and open to the public. But the public, what they are not, we once had a problem somewhere when others wanted to respond. We said, unfortunately, even if how much you are irritated by what is presented and you want to respond, it is not allowed. Mm-hmm. Even if we are outside the premises, only the committee has a right to participate on the activities. It is not only the members of the public, unfortunately. Even myself, if we do Babu Makeba and Babu Mkwen, even your delegation, they are not allowed to participate except to answer the questions that are being asked. So that's unfortunately the rules that were never created by us. I always say those who are advocates, they will tell you that never question the law. You must ask the law. When the rules are there, they apply until you change them. Unfortunately, some of the rules can be wrong, but as long as there are still rules in law, they have not been corrected or they have not been challenged, their validity, they remain the rules to apply. So I will agree with you, Honorable Mahlale, and hope that, like I said, they always say in the Kalahari, others when they clap hands, they no, you are not even allowed to clap hands. Just do not participate in the activities. But having said so, sorry about Makeba. Continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of the committee. Good morning, Honorable members of the committee. And thanks for that guidance, Chair. We also would like to thank you for inviting us to this, through our Honorable Minister, Gwedemantashe, who unfortunately, Chair, as you would have seen, that he couldn't make it for this meeting due to a joint Cabinet Committee meeting that is currently underway. We have nevertheless received the invite, and which has clearly outlined the areas that you would like us to cover for this particular meeting. Maybe because, Chair, some of the items that you specifically indicated in the invite relate mainly to Central Energy Fund Group, which is a very big subsidiary under the Department of Minerals and Energy. I would like to indicate that some of those areas will be fully covered by the Central Energy Fund Group. If the minister was here, most probably he would have used this opportunity as well, which I may take advantage of, Chair, that for Central Energy Fund, it's led by its newly appointed chairperson, Dr. Monde Nyande, who will also introduce the areas that will be dealt with under SEF Group, which is mainly the agreements that you wanted us to brief you on, particularly in relation to South Sudan and Petro SA of Jordan. As per the content of the invite, we'll give a framework of the international agreements and the generic principles that we basically use, and also to reflect on some of the international agreements that we have and the categorization. And then thereafter, from a departmental perspective, we'll reflect on the INGA project, which is a treaty that the department has been managing for quite some time, and that falls squarely within our area of responsibility. And Gareth Bessendenwood will be leading on that. And then with your permission, Chair, thereafter, we'll hand over to the chairperson of SEF Group, Dr. Monde Nyande, to reflect on their key areas of focus for your meeting. If you may allow me, Chair, I'll hand over to Mr. Bessendenwood to give you a very broad framework of our agreements and then zoom in specifically to INGA project before he hands over to the chairperson of the SEF Group. With your permission, Chair. I thank you. Gareth?
Thanks, DJ. I thought, DJ, I must also indicate, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that since the Chair has reiterated the rules of Parliament that I think all of us are aware of, I also need to use the space to indicate that this is my maiden presentation to a portfolio committee. So I assume the rules would apply in relation to how members engage, Chair, on the matter. But having said that, Chair, as the DG has indicated, we will commence basically in terms of how we understood the request from the Portfolio Committee to focus at the broader level with regards to specifically the department's international relations program, and then zoom into the four specific areas that was that information was requested on. As DG Zulu indicated, we will then do the presentation up to the point of cooperation with the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and specifically the Grand INGA project, and then after that hand over to the Chair of SEF, who will then direct the further three areas that was identified. So that basically outlines the content of what we will focus on. Just by way of background and context, Honourable Members and Honourable Chair would be aware that we are currently in the midst of a merger and reorganization process, and part of the key areas of focus is the consolidation of the international relations portfolio or program of the new department, DMRE. I must from the onset also indicate that this presentation would seem a bit energy heavy, but that is in the main because the specific areas that was identified actually falls within what was the old DOE portfolio. So in terms of contextual information and background, we would also focus on that. We basically give an indication, Chair, that we are mandated as a department to ensure transparent and effective regulation of the development of South Africa's minerals and energy resources. And we do so in order to meet our national objectives, as well as guaranteeing optimum benefit to the citizens of the country and attract foreign direct investment. At a high level, that is what drives our strategic mandate as a department. In order to attain the strategic objectives set in the sector that we represent, Chair, we do so guided by the National Development Plan, the NDSF, and we therefore identify, in line with the injunctions of those documents or directives from Cabinet, actually identify and prioritize our international partners within both jurisdictions, both mining and energy. Our diplomacy program is guided by various sets of bilateral and multilateral agreements that seeks to strengthen cooperation with other mining and energy jurisdictions, with the aim of firstly enhancing trade and investment, but also creating dialogue on pertinent sectoral issues. And also, our program broadly is guided by the objectives as espoused in the African Development Agenda, or AU as the Development Agenda 2063. And we seek to strengthen the relations on both the bilateral and multilateral front between South Africa with the SADC first and then with the rest of Africa. As indicated just now, Chair, in terms of our what guides our international relations approach, one is the NDP that sets out certain energy objectives around liquid fuels, around electricity, around nuclear and other areas. That is then further refined in terms of the government planning system, in terms of the medium-term strategic framework, which basically becomes the five-year implementation plan of the NDP, and which sets out certain priorities. Specifically, from an international relations point of view, we respond to two priority areas as identified by the President through SONA and is now contained in the MTSF for this term of government or for the sixth administration. And that is basically priority number one, which is economic transformation and job creation, and then priority number seven, which speaks to a better Africa and a better world. So accordingly, Chair, and honorable members, our program with regards to how we relate internationally is underpinned by a set of principles that we define internally. Firstly, we regard energy as a national security issue, and I think, as has been demonstrated with our specific challenges with regards to electricity supply, energy insecurity is a constraint to growth and development, and I think the Minister is on record having raised this matter very pertinently, and therefore it addresses broader issues or affects broader issues of energy security. In addressing our challenges, our core national interest, as the department lays in the provision of sufficient energy, both electricity and liquid fuels, to support our economic growth and social development, and we act in, or should at all times act in, support of national economic policy, be able to leverage regional and global opportunities that exist, and increase flows of energy trade and investment. As part of the reorganization process of the department that is currently underway, we are seeking, based on the guidance and advice of the Minister also, honorable members, we are trying to reorientate the focus of the international relations section of the DMRE to facilitate, in conjunction with partner departments or sister departments such as DTI and others, foreign direct investment in the mining and energy sector, as well as work towards strengthening human, institutional, technology, and infrastructure resources available to the country. As such, our approach in the main embraces, follows the policy junction as stated through our foreign policy as a country, and accordingly our approach embraces the African continent and SADC region as priority areas in terms of how we engage, and then flowing from that, South-South cooperation, and then North-South cooperation, which is basically the rest of the world in terms of how we prioritize our engagements outward missions. This slide, Chair, gives an overview of an overview summary of signed agreements on the energy side specifically. And it then identifies the branch or thematic area in which those agreements are or would fit. And then we indicate through the slide that we have currently a total of 72 agreements that are in place, of which, if you delve down, 49 of them are active. 7 are active but not in force, which means that they have not been ratified by either ourselves or the other party, counterparty. Mm-hmm. About 16 are actually dormant, completed, or expired, and this relates to agreements that either had an expiry date or was project-specific in relation to the issue that it was supposed to deal with. The case in point is, for instance, we had a program with the Kingdom of Norway around trading in the petroleum sector called the NORAD program. And at the point, the parties agreed to discontinue that program, which meant that the MOU that governed that program actually expired. So that gives a reflection of the status of all of these agreements currently. This slide is just an elaboration on that, and then gives a bit further information with regards to some of the bilateral level agreements that we have with countries such as Denmark, Germany, France, Russia, Switzerland, Norway, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Lesotho, Zambia, Botswana, Angola, Nigeria, Zambia, Mozambique, United States of America, People's Republic of China, and the Republic of Korea, or South Korea as we know it. Maybe a slight correction on this particular slide. It shouldn't say 49 anymore. On Friday, the minister signed an agreement with the Kingdom of Swaziland on energy cooperation. So that should actually now become 50, because it becomes, in our definition, active immediately upon signing, and the parliamentary process is something else. We will be submitting that agreement in terms of the defined parliamentary process in the coming period. It was signed on Friday in Pretoria. In terms of cooperation with SADC and the African continent, basically we reflect that our African agenda, Honourable Members Chair, is guided by Agenda 263 of the African Union, and it's premised on the commitment by African governments to pursue a sustainable development of energy generation capacity and infrastructure to support economic development in aid or to unearth the continent's industrial capacity. Priority in terms of the energy agenda on the continent is given to energy projects that have a regional impact and would seek to deepen regional integration, which is, for instance, some of the aspects that a project like, such as the Grand Inga would also focus on, beyond just the straightforward power generation potential. The vision for the development of the African Energy Program is basically to ensure energy security for the continent, ensure universal access. Honorable members would know that the continent has the lowest access numbers or statistics in the world. It is as estimated that just under 600 million Africans don't have access to any primary form of energy. Low energy cost, and then sustainability of supply. In terms of the EU specifically, our work and our participation in the main is within one of the specialized technical committees of the EU that is a ministerial level committee that focuses on those distinct areas of transport, transcontinental and interregional infrastructure, energy and tourism as specific focus areas. The last meeting of the specialized technical committee was held in Cairo in April this year, and we just give an overview, Chair, of some of the initiatives that guide the program at the continental level. Some of them to focus on is the efforts towards harmonized continental regulatory framework for the electricity sector, in order to also aid further economic development and make the cost of business and the ease of doing business a bit easier on the continent. So that work is underway, supported by those institutions, United Nations Economic Commission for Africa and the African Development Bank. We participate in what is called the Africa Bioenergy Policy Framework, given the fact that grid-based electricity access is at such low levels. One of the primary forms of energy used by African communities in the main is biomass-based. It's wood, it's coal. So part of what at the level of the EU is happening is that we're looking at ways to ensure that we find a more efficient and better ways to even manage the current penetration of those particular carriers within communities. And there's a policy framework that is under review that the EU has taken a decision must be delved down to regional level so that we have a regional focus and penetration. The Africa Renewable Energy Initiative is a a fairly recent decision by the AU, it's a state of government a summit that set up this particular initiative that is led by the president of Guinea, President Alpha Conde, as the champion, and basically unites all the different economic regions or economic communities within the continent into this particular program called Africa Renewable Energy Initiative that seeks to ensure a rapid increase in the penetration of renewable forms of energy on the continent. The structure is led by a what is called a board of directors that is comprises five heads of state from the regions, the five regions on the continent, and it's usually the chair of the specific economic community within a particular period. Like in this case now, as Tanzania is chairing SADC, they are would be representing and leading us there, both in the form of the president and the energy minister of that country. There's a long-standing relationship between the African Union and the EU with regards to what is called the Africa-EU partnership, and that program is continuing, and it seeks to ensure especially cooperation in the areas of capacity building and skills transfer and technology transfer. There's the African Commission on Nuclear Energy, AFCON, that is there, and part of the decisions of the SDC is the, of earlier this year is that African countries must consider, in line with our climate change commitments, must consider the development of affordable nuclear options in line with the IAEA requirements. The African Energy Commission is one area. It's a long-standing decision. This structure was set up a few years ago. There's been some teething problems, and I think this year has seen a sort of a push from the EU Commission to move towards full implementation. There was an agreement on the five key programs that AFREC must focus on, and they are reflected there. A key area of concern relates to the first bullet point there under AFREC, which speaks to Africa Energy Information System. One of the challenges or deficits on the continent is the availability of reliable energy data across all member states of the EU, AU, and part of what we have agreed is that there should be a dedicated effort with regards to that. And then we have the bioenergy program, as I've indicated earlier, oil and gas focus, the African Energy Efficiency Program, and then I think importantly so, a decision around a process that AFREC must lead with regards to energy sector transition and an African response or continental response to that. Lastly, in terms of the EU chair, we have the partnership at the EU level between the EU Commission and the International Energy Agency, of which in May this year there was a first ministerial meeting between IEA and AUC ministers responsible for energy was held in Addis Ababa earlier this year. Unfortunately, because of the transition period in government in South Africa, we could not participate. At the level of SADC, we basically participate in through the SADC Energy Senior Officials Meeting as well as the Minister's Annual Meeting. As is practice, SADC is chaired, or the SADC Energy Ministers is chaired by the Energy Minister or Minister responsible for energy of the country that has the chairship of SADC in the case of 2019-20, that is Tanzania. The previous year it was Namibia, and the year before that it was South Africa. Part of the key areas of focus within the SADC energy agenda related to a regional renewable energy strategy for SADC that was developed and approved by SADC energy ministers, as well as the establishment of the Southern African Center for Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency, which was established and is actually located in Namibia as the host country. I must indicate that we have not ratified our participation in SACRI as a country simply because there are some outstanding legal issues pertaining to the agreement, but that is underway and in process. We operate under the auspices of the SADC Regional Infrastructure Development Master Plan, and our work is guided by that. And specifically, we're also giving attention through our participation, for instance, of NERSA, into work to try and streamline and harmonize, again, in aid of trade and investment regionally, our electricity regulatory authorities, and NERSA is our former representative with regards to that process, together with other electricity regulators within the region. And then there's cooperation with regards to capacity building and so on, and this is mainly supported by a number of international partners. Of note to the department, in an area that we have prioritized here, is the SADC-led process of development of the regional gas master plan for the SADC region. That is a process that is underway and is also a decision that was sponsored by South Africa during our chairship of the SADC 2 years ago. Basically, Chair, we then give a broad reflection just that in terms of our efforts to ensure diversity of supply and access to energy resources, especially on the oil and gas side, we just reflect there on our cooperation with a number of countries. It is common cause that from the continent, Nigeria and Angola is our biggest suppliers, or African suppliers, of crude, but we also have engagements with Ghana, South Sudan, Equatorial Guinea, and that will be reflected on in the latter part of the presentation. We have the gas commissions with that is set up through mutual agreement between South Africa and Namibia on the one hand, and South Africa and Mozambique, and that work is and discussions and dialogue is ongoing. And as I've indicated, we are targeting or engaging with the African continent, mainly Angola and Nigeria, with regards to the supply of crude and crude trading, as well as Equatorial Guinea, Angola and Mozambique, with regards to the availability of gas. In terms of cooperation with the rest of the world, that's everything except Africa, Chair. And here we're focusing just at a high level on multilateral institutions. Of note, there is that we participate within the BRICS framework, within the BRICS energy track. There was just two, three days before the recent BRICS summit was the BRICS energy ministers meeting, where we participate both at officials level and then there is a ministerial level engagement. We participate in the G20. Honorable members would recall that South Africa is the only African country with G20 membership. And accordingly, we participate and we have that responsibility of not only representing our own interests, but also the aspirations of the continent in relation to G20. And we participate in what is called the Energy Transitions Working Group track. And there is an annual G20 Energy Ministers meeting that takes place and then feeds into the G20 Leaders Summit. We also have what is called association status with the International Energy Agency, which is a very key partner for us, especially in relation to the areas of capacity building and data availability. The IEA is renowned as a key influencer with regards to energy worldwide, and we have association status as signed last year in September. We participate in the African Petroleum Producers Association as a country, and then also in a number of some of these other forums. The International Energy Forum is one that I want to specifically mention also, simply because it is the largest gathering of energy ministers in the world. And South Africa has membership and actually participates at the level of the executive board, which is the governing structure of this institution. This slide just is a reflection, Chair, on the cleaner energy and climate change specific initiatives. We make mention of the fact that G20 Energy Transitions Working Group has a clear focus on that. We participate in the IPIC, or International Partnership for Energy Efficiency Cooperation, the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum that specializes on the development and work towards cleaner coal technologies, and specifically working with Australia, the UK and Norway with regards to that. We are members of the Clean Energy Ministerial, and then we have a very elaborate cooperation with Germany in the form of the South African-German Energy Cooperation in the sector that also has that element, as well as with Denmark, of which we are currently implementing phase two of that program. In terms of capacity building, all our agreements have a distinct element that seeks to ensure that we are able to get not only from a human development point of view, but also technology exchange. There would have an element of capacity building and information sharing and support. We mentioned the issue of the MOU with the International Energy Agency again, because specifically this has allowed us access to a wide array of energy-related data sets, models, and so on that would actually help our own energy planning processes in the country. We participate in the International Atomic Energy Agency, which also provides extensive training for the sector. And then also we participate very actively in the International Renewable Energy Agency, or IRENA. With regards to access of funding, we do still receive finance and technical assistance through a number of bilateral level agreements or trilateral agreements, in this case Germany, Denmark, Switzerland, Norway, the US and the World Bank actually support some of the initiatives that we have. And then we just give a reflection that I won't mention them around capacity building and training in the sector. Specifically in relation to the grant INGA, Chair, honorable members would remember that South Africa concluded a treaty specifically with regards to the grant INGA project. And basically this treaty seeks to set an enabling framework that links the DRC in South Africa into the project, which is the Grand Inga project, and allowing for the two countries to jointly explore economically feasible options for the development of the project. The treaty provides for certain institutional arrangements on the side of DRC. Part of what is contained in there is the establishment of the structure that they call ADEPI, or the Inga Development Authority, which is a DRC-led process. And then jointly we have the Joint Ministerial Committee that is the committee of the two ministers responsible for energy, that is supported by a joint permanent technical committee of senior and technical officials that deals with the INGA project. Basically, we reflect on some of the commercial aspects of the treaty, what the treaty contains as it is. And basically, in the treaty, if certain conditions are met, South Africa commits to buy power generated from phase one, or what is colloquially called INGA 3, and subsequent phases from the Grand INGA project and DRC. South Africa does not carry any project development risk, but only acts as a buyer if the power is supplied. Phase one in the Grand INGA 3, the INGA 3 specific project, is associated with the following. One is that we estimate that there will be a reduction in tariff costs due to the development of the common works, and the fact that work would mainly happen on that side, on the DRC side of the project, driven by the DRC government, and the project was taken up on that side, on the construction side. That there will be cost due to the transmission line to Kolwezi, as initially indicated, which was supposed to be the evacuation point to then bring that power via the South African power pool to South Africa. There's the investment by South Africa in the construction of the transmission infrastructure, as I've indicated, from the point of delivery on the DRC border, and then the initial commitment to offtake 2,500 megawatt by the Republic and 2,300 megawatt by DRC, and assistance in the mobilization of funding. That basically constitutes the key tenets of what is contained in the existing treaty. In return, the DRC agreed to give South Africa the right of first refusal with regards to both equity and offtake in respect of any and all future phases of the project and any related hydroelectric development in the Congo River in and around the INGA complex if South Africa proceeds with phase one. In terms of the right of refusal and offtake specifically, South Africa as a country is guaranteed, apart from the set commitment that we have made for 2,500 megawatt, is guaranteed a minimum of 20% of generated power from the Grand INGA scheme, equal to 9,540 megawatt and up to a maximum of 13,060 megawatt, and then anything beyond this could still be negotiated. It is anticipated that the economics of the project will be more favorable due to, as I've indicated earlier, the common works being completed and projects significantly de-risked on the DRC side as more phases are added and generation cost per megawatt will decline. And therefore, it's critical that South Africa has this right of first refusal. And it is our, we anticipate that we'll be guaranteed access to cheaper and cleaner power if future phases actually goes ahead. This slide just gives a reflection of, or an illustration of the transmission challenge that we would have with regards to bringing the power from the Inga project, which is basically in the left corner of that slide, is where the actual generation project is located, and that power will then have to be evacuated to from there to, or transmitted from there, transferred from there to Kolwezi. There is a current discussion also underway with regards to taking it a bit further down to another area that we will reflect on now. And then it will have to via a number of countries within the South African power pool to actually reach ultimately South Africa over a very long distance. It's about 3,700, give and take, to South Africa from the point of origin. Proposed delivery points reflect on in the treaty, and in terms of the initial discussions, the delivery of the power would have been Katanga. There are discussions underway with the DRC side to actually see if the power cannot be evacuated for use in the power pool, then at the point of an area called Kasumbalesa in the DRC. It's closer to the DRC-Zambian border. And there are basically two options that we are considering in this regard. One is a full delivery of the power supply, or the full offtake from the DRC via what they call in the industry a flyover, which is basically a direct system of taking the power from DRC straight to South Africa. The other option that we are discussing with our sister countries in the region relates to integrating what we then offtake from Inga into the South African power pool network, and then actually do energy trading along the route. This is the discussion that is underway, and as we indicate there, the transit countries must jointly agree on the Katanga or Kasumbalesa process to South Africa and the entire solution and what it means, and that is a very, very complex discussion. Current candidates will just give a reflection of the DRC-led process with regards to the developers of the project. I will not focus on that too much, save to indicate that in terms of their own process, they have actually identified two qualifying consortia that has been appointed to preferred bidder status, and they give an indication there, ECS Grupo-led, and the other one, a Chinese-led consortium, which was subsequently directed by DRC to submit joint offer. There's offers received regarding tariff proposals as far as we are informed. That discussion is underway. We are, as a country, awaiting the formal appointment of the joint consortium by DRC, comprising the Spanish and Chinese companies as indicated above. In terms of next steps, that is in the main on the side of the DRC, is the negotiation with the Republic with regards to defining the transmission project, engagement from our side or between the two parties on the PPA term sheet, and then to finalize the tariff protocol and technical protocol on the basis of the negotiated PPA term sheet. With regards to the transmission specifically, we are collaborating on the studies with regards to the demand and transmission study. And information gather process involves information gathering with regards to demand projections in some of the countries along the route and other African countries or other SADC countries. Feasibility study on the transmission options beyond DRC, which is in the main led by the utilities, and then the ongoing discussions between the identified transit countries, although we must indicate that there's also renewed interest from both Angola and Namibia with regards to participating in the transmission and offtake arrangements when agreed between South Africa and the DRC. In terms of latest developments, SADC energy ministers formally endorsed the Inga project in June 2016. This year, during the SADC Energy Ministers meeting, an update was provided with by the Minister of responsible for ADEPI on the side of the DRC. And basically, the SADC Energy Ministers have directed that the countries that were initially identified between the parties for the transmission solution. The DRC, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, and South Africa must meet to finalize the transmission option. And accordingly, we have shared a draft MOU within the power, South African power pool, who we have also agreed would assist to facilitate that process. That has indicated the technical team exists that is basically comprised of representatives across the five utilities that looks at the more technical side of the transmission solution as is proposed through the transit countries, Chair. That comprises the first portion up to Grant Inga, Chair, and I will now, with your indulgence, hand over to the Chair of Central Energy Fund to then lead the process going further. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of Parliament, for giving us this opportunity, the Director General is with me. Following Mr. Bezaden, what I will also say, this is my maiden appearance, and therefore would request the same treatment as he has in the process of questioning. Mr. Chairperson, I would like to first introduce, with your permission, the delegation that comes from CERF. We have the acting CEO of CERF, that is with me, the chairperson of PetroSA, and the acting CEO of PetroSA, the chairperson of IGAS, and the chairperson of SSF, the CEO of SFF, and also the chairperson of IGAS, and the vice president of PetroSA is here. The areas that we're going to cover are those of South Sudan oil agreement with SFF. Definitely the technical people are here who will definitely expand on my exposition, and the Saudi Aramco agreement, which will be covered also by the Central Energy Fund and the CEO, beyond what I was going to say. The PetroSA agreement with Rosneft agreement, which will be covered by PetroSA. Mr. Chairman, there's never a time in the South African economy when the economy is in the downward phase of the business cycle that energy is a critical sector for both investments and for both for improving the balance of payments position and improving the South Africa's economic growth, which indeed will be able to tackle the major problem of the South Africa, which is the unemployment rate. I therefore make these remarks that these projects, and I steal the concept from me, from you, which says time is enemy of progress. These agreements have been signed quite a long time ago. They have not been implemented. They have been implemented in a slow pace, and we plan to move forward at a faster pace. These projects are very strategic to the country, to CFS, and support the security of energy supply to the country. The Rosneft Group agreement, if I may start with it, is very critical to CERF and the country and the department, as it mitigates the risk of gas supply, which is falling the technical limit. If I can put it very cleanly, the current limit or utilization is 40% of the total capacity utilization in the refinery. And that is critical. This is projected to happen around 2020 December, and is serious threat to the continued operation of the refinery. Rosneft will undertake gas production optimization from the current gas producing wells, thus extending the gas supply to the refinery in the immediate term. In the long run, Mr. Chairperson, which is definitely 3 to 5, that is 5 years to 10 years and beyond, Rostio, together with us as Petro-S AN SEF partnership, intends drilling and additional gas in the South Coast for long-term, as I say, supply to the Petro-SA refinery. The Central Energy Fund and the Petro-SA boards are alive to the fact that while Rostio's partnership may help us with gas feedstock supply and avert the December 2020 gas supply crisis, we cannot rest on our laurels. Petro-SA has to improve its operational efficiency, reduce its burdensome high fixed cost structure. The board of Petro-SA and the new board is doing that at this moment, a month after he has put in place, in order to be financially sustainable. These projects with the international partners can only be successful, Mr. Chairperson, or successfully executed, if the Central Energy Fund is properly capacitated with permanent, qualified, and experienced executives. Following advertisements, which were published 2 weeks ago, that was a week when the new boards were put in place. In fact, it was 4 days when we were told that we're in place, that we put adverts for applications for the SEF Group CEO, Petro-SA, and IGAS, and all other subsidiaries. These positions closed last Friday, which was the 15th of November. We were given by the Minister of Minerals and Energy that by December the permanent positions should be in place. They are critical in the sense that if the executives at the top are not permanent, then that tends to permeate downwards and slow down the work ethic, and then the morale of the entity becomes very low. Over the next 2 weeks, the boards will conduct interviews, that is starting next week for the SEF. In fact, I think Saturday, that's what we have aimed for. We are on track to submit our recommendation candidates to the Minister of Minerals and Energy by the end of this month. It's up to the Minister by December to make sure that these positions are filled and the executives of these institutions are actually stabilized. Over the next 2 weeks, as I said, the interviews will be conducted, and the proposed new refinery project in Richards Bay between SEF and Saudi Aramco is a mega project that can significantly contribute to reignite this nation state's economy. It will create as much as 5,000 permanent jobs during the useful commercial life of the new refinery. And indeed, that will contribute at least to reducing the current unemployment rate of 29.3%, definitely not to normalized levels of 25%, but even beyond that, during the useful commercial of the new refinery. In addition to more than 21,000 jobs that will be created during the refinery's 5-year construction period. Mr. Chairperson and honorable members, the partnership with Rostio has been chosen, is at the heart of Petro-SA's survival beyond December 2020 date. When gas supply is projected to fall below technical limits, as I've mentioned, of 40% of the refinery, there was a competitive process undertaken for identifying partners at Rostio and made the best commercially attractive offer. Rostio made the best commercially attractive offer. Finalizing the commercial terms of the agreement has been delayed, as I mentioned that, by more than 3 years. It is very important, therefore, Mr. Chairperson, that Petro-SA finalizes this agreement with Rostio so that Rostio can start production optimization and well work over programs from the producing gas fields. this is probably the best option for vetting the 2020 gas supply crisis at the refinery. The Saudi Arabia or Aramco agreement with the Republic, in the last 10 years, there has been very limited investment in the country's refining capacity. From 2002, South Africa started imported refinery transport fuels, that is petrol and diesel. The imports of petrol and diesel is currently 140,000 barrels per day. We don't take into consideration since then the movement in the exchange rate. And definitely you know what it means from 2002 to 2003 where the rand exchange rate was to the dollar. This is equivalent to exporting the number of refinery jobs created by Sasol. If no investments are made in the country's refineries now, imports will grow quite significantly, which is not good to the security of energy supply, and this negatively impacts the country's balance of payments position. You know where the current account deficit is currently is. You know the overall balance of payments to output growth is. Indeed, we're still in the positive if you look at the overall balance of payments position. But definitely the current account deficit remains negative and worrisome. And if this project can be undertaken, there is no doubt in our way that we can improve, and that would help us even in the credit rating agencies to really improve our position. Saudi Aramco agreement is between SEF and Saudi Aramco to undertake a feasibility study and build a new refinery in Richards Bay. This mega infrastructure project will have the much needed positive economic impact in our country. On the South Sudan, which can also be elucidated extensively by the chairperson of SFF and the CEO of SFF, the agreement is for SFF to participate in all exploration in one of South Sudan's oil blocks. It is one of the potentially rich block in South Sudan that will have definitely enough oil for us, and it will do this project. We have to do it in partnership with strategic partners. All these projects, we cannot do them by ourselves. We have to have partners. That's how investments actually will come to South Africa and will grow the South African economy, is to have the partnership with the institutions. The project will also include the pipeline and refinery in South Sudan. What will this do? Again, if you look at the capital account and the balance of payments position, that will be able to repatriate some dividends that will be coming from that country, which will definitely have a positive impact on the exchange rate and the stability in the currency of our country. SFF, again, is here. Will adhere to all the PFMA requirements and CF limited, that is CEF limits of delegation of authority in implementing the project. In very short and sweet, that is the agreements that we have, the likelihood of having them a positive impact, and we want to make sure that we hasten, we put these agreements and implement to implementation, so that our country can be able to be on the growth path that it used to be again. I thank you very much. The CEO of SEF, if I may, Mr. Chairman Kinnear.
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members, DGs, the chairpersons and colleagues, good morning. Chair and the committee, I'll take you through the three agreements. So later on, when we deal with questions, we'll then ask the CEOs to complement, but I'll cover the entire presentation. The first part will deal with the cooperation between South Africa and the Republic of South Sudan in a project called Nile Orange Energy Project. Just, I think, for information, the reason the project is called Nile Orange, if you go to South Sudan, their biggest river is the Nile River. If you go to South Africa, our biggest river is the Orange River. So that is where the name comes from, just to appreciate and celebrate the rivers of our country. South Sudan is the third biggest oil reserve base in the Sub-Sahara after Nigeria and Angola. And through government-to-government relationship, an opportunity was provided for acquisition of exploration blocks in South Sudan. It becomes very critical for SFF and the SEF group that plays a role in the energy of security of supply to look for opportunities where we can acquire assets in terms of crude oil so that we can position the entity for security of supply. And therefore, the work in terms of the technical analysis, economical analysis, appraising the opportunity, assessing it before following the due approval processes needs to be undertaken. The framework was signed so that we can be able to do that work. In terms of the strategic rationale, common practice, it is normal that countries that have very low reserves of oil and gas would seek opportunities outside their boundaries so that they can have a position in foreign countries. For example, India imports about 80% of their hydrocarbons that come from equity positions in foreign countries. So it is a norm in the oil and gas space when countries are not endowed with hydrocarbons to look at partnerships outside the borders of that country so that you can be able to position yourself and have your crude and liquid supply, taking advantage of the geology of other countries and also monetizing some of the government-to-government relationship. The Block 2 has potential to contribute to the strategic objectives of the entity. We do believe that by the position we have taken through SFF in terms of the equity shares of the hydrocarbons, it will enable us as a country to have access to hydrocarbons so that we can deal with our strategic stock and also improve in terms of the balanced portfolio of our hydrocarbons and our assets. So this is very critical from strategic projects. Other benefits is that this will offer South Africa access to blended crudes so that we can supply South African refineries. Refineries generally, they need to blend their diet so that they can be able to optimize. So SFF, which stores strategic stock, it's important that our access to crude is crude that can be processed by the other oil refineries, and therefore important to have a position where we are able to blend those crudes. Moreover, it is important for us to unlock the downstream opportunity from a trading perspective. We cannot always be the one who will be buying crude, but it is important also to take a trading position so that we can also commercially go into the open markets. And so this offers us that opportunity that if that crude is not refined locally, there is a potential that we can also trade it in the international markets and therefore improving the cash flows that comes into the country. So it is access to crude. It is also the opportunity to trade so that we can generate funds. Are also very important. It's important for any commercial entity and strategic entity to have a balanced portfolio so that you are able to pursue your strategic and developmental mandate whilst you also pursue your commercial mandate. So this offers us that opportunity, which will further strengthen the balance sheet of the strategic fuel fund whilst it enhances the balance sheet of the SEF group. In terms, when you have an opportunity like this, you need to develop it so that you can properly quantify the opportunity so that you can also be able to see if you are able to progress it into the next phase. This opportunity, when it came, it became essential for us to use expertise of people with experience, companies with experience, that will be able to do a due diligence, audit the potential that is there, not just rely on the information that were being given by the third party. And in order to be prudent, we then appointed PetroVision, which is an independent petroleum exploration audit company, whose task was really to do a technical and commercial assessment of the opportunity that was presented to us, so that we don't just rely on the information that we're given by a potential partner, and so that we can be able to say we've done our own assessment. We also have an assessment that has been done by a third party that really affirms the opportunity technically and also commercially before we can be able to move forward, and that is done. Secondly, we are to then approach the South Sudan Ministry of Petroleum to engage on the opportunity, because you first quantify the opportunity, then say, but I need to now move and develop it. One of the very critical aspects in exploration and production in the upstream space is to develop what is called an exploration and production rights sharing agreement. If this becomes the trigger for you to sign an agreement with the entity, so you to be able to move into the next phase. And when we, earlier on, the project was developed, this was the critical aspects that exploration and production agreement is developed and signed by the two parties. In terms of the original schedule, this exploration and production sharing was supposed to have been concluded on the 30th of April. We were 6 days late. I need to say, Chair, we were 6 days late. Noting that generally, as South Africans, we are known to have projects that runs in terms of overruns and schedules and other things. But we note that we're not on schedule. However, we're just 6 days late. So the signing of the exploration and production agreement was on the 6th of May. And the schedule to develop this was negotiated well in advance. And we're 6 days late. I need to emphasize that. I think what we're doing here is just to show the geographical location of where South Sudan is and the pipeline. I think important on the slide, what we are showing in terms of this graph is block 2B, which is that red block that you see there. It's surrounded. Around it, you can see the purple and the green, where currently there are other parties that are already producing. So we have an opportunity in an exploration block that is surrounded by areas where we are already producing, which begins to give you that the geology and the presence of hydrocarbons in that area, you can have a high degree of certainty, because it is not an area that has not been explored before. It is not an area where you've not produced before. So if you just look at that, it gives you from an upstream point some degree of confidence in terms of the geology. And also, if you look at the number of players in that area, you are not doing frontier exploration. So what do I mean? You are not the first one to go into that area. You are going to an area that is known and people have produced, and there are technologies that exist that you can be able to leverage on, so that you can be able to produce that oil and be able to pursue your objectives. This was the schedule that was originally negotiated. As I said, the deadline initial was end of April. We then also did it in May. Importantly, to indicate, Chair and the Honourable Members, agreements of this nature, when you are not very agile, when you don't have a dedicated team, at times the development of that agreement can take you up to 2 years. And that is why at times we've lost opportunities. So the strategy that we undertook, because we then realized that when we're seeking for these opportunities, there were other potential bidders. There were people that were also interested in getting that opportunity. So we had to move with speed and ensure that we are able to take the first position in that case. So this is something that we can celebrate, that ordinarily, if we had not formed a concentrated team, we had not had a task team and a strategy, ordinarily this would have taken us 18 months to 2 years. We would have lost the opportunity. But because of the criticality of this opportunity, what it will do to the balance of payment, to the issues of security of supply, it was important for us to move with agility. And this is why we were able to move. Whilst others wanted to move, we had already moved into the first position. The opportunity of this nature, you need to also develop your own funding plan. So what we have here, the first phase of any exploration and production opportunity, you need to be able to fund your exploration activities. Generally, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, if you look into the value chain of upstream, it will start off with exploration, then you'll go to appraisal, development, etc. Banks, for example, do not fund exploration. It is done by international oil companies and national oil companies, because banks want a project that has already been de-risked. So the first phase, we are currently undertaking exploration, which is, we are saying that exploration, the commitment we are able to fund from our own balance sheet, and it is equivalent to about $48 US million. However, I do need to emphasize, Chair, the committee, we have seen an incest from multinationals, from players with experience that wants to partner with us. And one of the critical things in upstream is to, you look at how you de-risk the project by ensuring you invite partners that has money, that has the technical capabilities, so that the risk is not just concentrated on you. So this is something that we are currently, we have currently our equity position, which is about 90%, and carrying the 10% of South Sudanese, but we are saying we need to be prudent and be good stewards and take advantage of people with the financial muscle, with the technology and technical capabilities. So therefore, the team is currently looking at engaging potential partners so that we can be able to de-risk, so that we can pursue this opportunity. What we do see, and we need to emphasize, Chair, without really going into the details of the opportunity, because it is a commercial opportunity, we need to protect that. We are being good stewards in terms of the South African money that we need to be investing elsewhere. We've negotiated in a way that we believe it will be appropriate for the country, and later on, when everything else is finalized, we'll be able to show that it is a viable investment. It is an investment that I think as a country we'll be able to show this is the commercial benefit. As we are saying, we currently are de-risking the project. So that summarizes, Chair, and the committee, basically, the first opportunity. So what we are saying, for any country that doesn't have hydrocarbons, it doesn't mean you cannot play in the oil and gas space. So you go and look for partners. The second opportunity, South Africa, I think the chairperson has already indicated, has a growing shortage of high-quality fuels. South Africa imports final products. And also, there's a lot of importation of chemicals into the country. It becomes important that we create a competitive economic environment, and we ensure that in order to create jobs, we increase the manufacturing capacity of the country and the competitiveness, so that we can take advantage of the economic environment. So the agreement between SAF and Saudi Aramco is informed by that a need to increase the manufacturing capability and ensure we remain competitive economically. So we have a cooperation agreement to jointly develop the refinery in Richards Bay. High level, in terms of the project description, we're looking at developing a project in Richards Bay with a capacity of about 300,000 barrels per day. The reason in the notes, share in the committee, we are saying needs to be confirmed. When you start a project, you have a particular view. Then you look, you do a detailed marketing study, you quantify the opportunity, then you look at configurations and design, and you begin to affirm. So this is one thing that we've done. Critical in terms of location, you need to have your refinery closer to your markets, so that the products you produce, you are able to place into the market. As a SAF group, we compete with international oil companies that operate commercially, and therefore becomes important that in everything that we do, despite our own developmental mandate, we honor our commercial mandate and we become competitive. Therefore, the location was chosen from that perspective. We're also saying the country is importing what is called Euro 5, what in South African terms I'll call what we've called Clean Fuels 2 specification, which is fuels that meet some of the environmental regulations, and that is important into what is called BLNS, which is your Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, because that is currently integrated into the South African supply. We are then saying we can't in 2025, build a refinery that does not take into the future what are the environmental requirements and fuel specifications of the future. So the refinery is not being designed for the current specifications. It's designed for future specifications, and so that we can be able to move. We are also saying, as a country and the region, we need to position ourselves for producing chemicals, and this is in line with some of the strategies that are currently being led by TTI, so that as a country we can increase our position. We will be accessing the market through the multi-product pipeline between Durban and Gauteng. So I think, Chair and the committee, just to say, there is no pipeline, as we speak today, between Lucha and Free State and Gauteng. Yet there is a pipeline that can be fully utilized and be leveraged between the Durban region and Gauteng. So therefore, important for us to access the market at this stage. In terms of developing the refinery complex, we are currently in pre-feasibility, Chair, in the committee. The estimated cost is about $10 billion. So we'll then, once we've completed feasibility, we'll be able to further quantify the cost. Location, as I indicated, Chair, it is about 15 kilometers from Richards Bay, from the coast. Currently, that the land is currently being utilized by SAPI for forestry. There is conversations in that regard. The size is about 1,200 hectares, and there's potential for import crude. Just to indicate, Chair, the area that we've identified, there's an opportunity in terms of the Richards Bay IDZ to transform it into a special economic zone. And therefore, this opportunity, this is what it begins to create for that area, whilst we respect the environmental and ensuring that forestry is also not negatively impacted holistically. In terms of the milestone of the project, it was about the signing of the MOC, the Memorandum of Cooperation, in May. We've completed the market study because we need to quantify the opportunity. That is done. The team is currently finalizing the engineering and the configuration end of November. So that is being finalized so that by end of December we complete pre-feasibility. From there, the next phase becomes you further de-risk the project. You go into feasibility. You then deal with some, you study the technology, the configuration, and you de-risk it properly before you go to front-end and engineering and design, and you deal with some of the environmental concerns. FID at this stage is planned for March 2023 so that you can start with the implementation and construction. Then we foresee that the refinery will come online 2027-2028. That is our current schedule. In terms of, as I said, currently the issues is the acquisition of land by the Richards Bay IDZ. One of the critical issues, Chair, in the committee, if you develop a mega project, you can't import everything that you need. It is not just about the creation of the 23,000 jobs during construction. We are saying there's an opportunity to develop business in South Africa. So one of the things we're looking at is to say, how do we increase the local content? How do we develop supply development? Which of these technologies, which of the equipment we need to be ensure it is not imported into the country, but we are able to work with local businesses so that the economy can grow? So this is what it begins to create, so that indeed when the country talks about industrialization, it is something that we move beyond tokenism, but we can create opportunities for it to be realized. As I said, one of the critical issues, if you are developing any refinery, you need to be able to access to have accessibility to your crude to move your products. This has created an opportunity for us to partner with Transnet. There is currently conversations which in the very near future will be announcing, looking at doing a joint study agreement between the SERF Group and Transnet around the importation, around the pipeline, and the port infrastructure. So this is the current that we are working towards finalizing that joint study agreement. As I said, one of the critical issues for this is to ensure that we are compliant with all Clean Fuels 2 specification. One of the things that we are looking at is to say the product, in terms of the competitiveness of the refinery, we need to create an opportunity so that traders do not have to go to India to import product. So that's the type of design we have in mind, so that we can have a very competitive from a pricing, and so that we can also compete with those that are importing fuel into the country. Infrastructure, as I said, if you look into the RBIDZ at the moment, there's an opportunity to develop your utilities infrastructure and the supporting infrastructure so that can be classified as a special economic zone. I think I've spoken to those. I think that basically, Chair, summarizes that, so which is part of the pre-feasibility that we'll be completing, and in the near future, the Minister will then announce at the appropriate time. The last agreement, Chair, is the agreement that I think the Chair has given a preamble between PetroSA and Rosgea. But before we go into the meat of that agreement, Chair, and the committee. It's important to give a bit of historical context that the Republic of South Africa and the Russian Federation signed an agreement of cooperation in March 2013 in Durban. And thereafter, there was a joint intergovernmental committee on trade and this, and this opportunity in 2014 was then crystallized and seen. By 2015, PetroSA and Rossio signed a memorandum of understanding on how this partnership could be explored. An opportunity was seen to partner around what is known as Exploration Right 61 to make life easy. It is in the area where we are producing with our refinery so that we can address the declining feedstock issue. As the chairperson has indicated, it becomes important for us to deal with the feedstock issue. So this was foreseen at that stage. Towards end of 2015, PetroSA embarked on what we call a farm-out process. Simplistically, Chair and the committee, it was a process to invite partners or any other commercial entity that has an interest in getting some equity into the block, that is willing to put in their money and bring in their technical skills so that the risk does not sit with the process. And this was an open, competitive process, despite change. Despite having signed an MOU with Rosgio, despite the government-to-government relationship, we saw it fit because of the criticality of the feedstock issue. Petro say that let's not only talk to the ones where there's an MOC, but we also explore the market. This is how critical it is. This was a deliberate strategy that was had been taken. We could have pursued just on the government to government. The laws of this country allows us, but we thought it was prudent to create a competitive process. The farm-out strategy is to ensure we leverage on partnership to find gas and the feedstock for the refinery. This is at the core of this relationship, Chair. So because we needed to move from having PetroSA having a two-year life and three-year life and ensure we can have sustainable operations for 10 to 15 years and we prevent any job losses. This is the fundamental and the DNA of this relationship. And also to ensure we reduce any financial exposure to our entity with respect to exploration. Noting, Chair, that agreement came in just a year after we had reported 15 billion losses on Ikwezi. On Project Ikwezi, PetroSA did everything 100% on their own. However, in here we are saying we need to have partners that will come, carry the technical and the financial risk without us risking any state money, and we will be able to fund it, will be carried. In upstream, there's something called a state carry, where later in you can use proceeds from production to cover your portion of your equity so that you don't risk your money in the early phase. So this was the strategy. So it's very important. It creates an opportunity. It supports, Chair, and the committee that drive for 100 billion investment. It unlocks the ocean's economy of the country so that more wells can be drilled. So it has the financial potential 5 billion investment that the partners can bring. And also in terms of our decommissioning liability, then it would not be triggered because it'll be extending the life of the refinery and extending the life of the FA platform. I think basically what you have in the chair is just to show you the various blocks that we have. What you have is called Block 9. This is the area for more than 20 years that PetroSA has been producing for. So in terms of the geology, even though it is not in the deep sea, similarly to where Total is, as found in terms of the exploration, but it's near our production, and therefore it is an opportunity that we believe needs to be explored, and there is opportunity in that regard. So as I indicated earlier on, Chair, what we have shown here is that within that area, the map that I've showed, there is a potential in terms of investment that we see. From our current area of production, you can see the 359 billion, and there's other opportunities. So we are saying in upstream, to develop the upstream industry of our country, there's opportunities for investment if we attract funders from outside the country. So I think to summarize, I've already touched on the slide earlier on. We commenced the farm out in 2015 and attracted partners. We then had to also appoint a transactional advisor. And we also needed to give those potential partners. We had two entities that it offered. One was the Rosgio, as I indicated, and Solihull. Through a competitive process, having looked at the requirements, we then selected a preferred partner. One thing, Chair, I need to indicate, even though we know that in terms of law, we are supposed to have BEE with 10%. At the time of bidding, the companies that bid it, it was only Solihull that had that, and Rosshi at the time did not have. And the process allows us to progress, but before we go into production, we can then bring in BEE. So we said it was important for us to deal with people that missed the requirement and not temper it end to the end and follow the necessary due process. Okay? So I think, as I said, we looked at an opportunity that is favorable to PetroSA. There's been a number of negotiations, clarity. A framework agreement was signed at BRICS 2017 that was announced, and a framework agreement sets out the boundaries for you to really negotiate further so that you can develop a supply agreement and a commercial terms. As we are sitting here, Chair, and the committee, unfortunately, those have not yet been finalized. There are meetings to try and pursue that. I think in closing, the chairperson indicated this is the opportunity that we are looking at pursuing so that we can extend the life of the refinery so that when we come to the portfolio committee in January, we do not talk about December 2020. We can talk about the long-term plan of the refinery using gas and explore those opportunities. And for today, Chair, I won't dwell much into that. I'll allow the space that the committee has offered us in January when we come back to give details of the PetroSA turnaround plan. But I think what is important is just to indicate the partnership with Rosgio in terms of ensuring we extend life, we get gas, it is critical and it's the DNA of ensuring that operations continue to run. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chairperson and the members, that concludes the task that we have placed on our shoulders for this meeting today. We await your input.
Yeah, 3 hours of depth, however. 3 hours of depth. Okay, honorable members, can I first make this request, honorable members? It's allowed in the House that we converse, but can we try so that we don't get to disturb each other, that we do it with the smartest of our voices. Well, sometimes the conversation becomes a bit higher and end up competing with the speakers. That's point one. Point two, those who go out, please, the conversation can be a little bit far from the door so that we don't end up being interested in what is happening outside. And when you come in, we look at you, we start to look at you with what you were saying outside, so that we become less interested when you say. You may end up saying something that we're not supposed to hear inside. So can that conversation also be equal to us? Having said so, some Buddha was asking me the chair of FEF, before pleading for your case, we don't know the other chairpersons that you were mentioning. Now, I don't want us to extend and appreciate and congratulate you with an added advantage without telling us who are the names of the other chairpersons. You only introduced yourself and without introducing the other. You. Now my members, some of them were asking many questions. Fortunately, in their conversation, they were conversing very low to an extent you didn't even hear what they were trying to get. We hear there's chair for IGAS, there's chair for SFF, there's chair for PetroSA, and when we sit here, we sit by assumption. So we don't want... There is some entities I won't mention because fortunately they're not here. You sit
you get someone is a CEO in this entity, then when you go on the other side to find the CEO of that entity is a chair of the board on the other entity. Now you expect that it's a CEO that is being introduced, but now it's no longer the CEO, it's a chair of the entity. So I don't want to assume that the CEO that I once had yesterday is still the CEO, and only to find that is a chair of the board, and you never shared with us. Can you start for doing what that?
My
or maybe the person who did the disservice, by the way, is the DG, not you.
Okay.
Okay.
No, my apologies, Chair. I was just sensitive to time, unfortunately. Mr. Chair, I think so that you hear their voices, they can introduce themselves. I know how they are. But I will start with the acting CEO. Would you introduce yourselves?
Thank you, Chair, and the honorable members. My name is Koleki Lesono, acting CEO of SEF.
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members. My name is Linda Lindle, the new chairperson of IGAS.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Neville Mompati. I'm chairing the Strategic Fuel Fund.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. My name is Godfrey Mwahi. I'm the CEO at SFL.
Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Franz Baleni, Chairperson of PetroSA.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Bongani Saidini. I'm the Acting CEO at PetroSA.
Morning, Chair. My name is Salim Subada. I'm the Acting Vice President of Upstream at PetroSA.
Okay, thank you. At least we wanted those who are sitting in front. Babu Zono knows we once went there. And when they were introducing, someone was sitting there, and then we were told he's part of the delegation. So at least now all of you are sitting in front. We know that you are equally responsible and equally liable for whatever that is here. Honorable members, having said so, welcome to the new leadership of the SEF group. We hope you have already been inducted on the work to be done, and hopefully we will work well together. Our task here is to help you succeed, but equally our task here is to hold you accountable and responsible on the decisions that you make or you preside over. So we do both. When it is nice to laugh, we laugh even more than you laugh. But when we have to turn our faces to be something else, probably. So please, make it a point that you don't want to see the other side. Let's keep the smiling and laughing side of things quite well. Honorable members, I know sometimes when I worked, time is never a major issue. There is the report. Can I do this favor? Besides any other matter, for honorable members who wants to have a take, we start with without limiting the foregrounding. For instance, on the analysis of international agreement, that is not a major issue. We can put that together, but I want us to be in a more structured way. We start with Grand Inga, where the honorable members want to have a take, and then we will go to what's the next? it's South Sudan, ne? And three, it's gonna be the Saudi Arabia, and then the last one will be Petro SA Rosio. Please wake up, so that I don't say when I'm already gone past that one, then the honorable member thinks, ish, Chair, I'm still there. We are now on any matter. If we don't finish, and I must say this thing, one of the things, Chair of SEF, one of the things I said, nothing, if we don't finish, at least those, if they didn't advise you, we, we will come back. There is nothing, we don't want anything that is, we rather disagree with finalizing than agreeing. We disagree with finalizing than agreeing without finalizing. So anything must be exhausted, we must get all the answers, we must be satisfied, even if it means being unhappy. We must be unhappily satisfied that the question has been given. Now we have got a basis to dispute what is a fact or what is correct and what is not correct. So it's nice to know what you disagree on than to disagree just by virtue of arrogance sometimes, because you just want to put a strong face. That is not the issue. Okay, honorable members, anyone who wants to have a take on Grand Inga and the other initial foregrounding statement, Honorable Phillips, Honorable Mylem, just a simple exercise, please, for the sake of fast-tracking the meeting. Fortunately, you all have got, you see, the chairperson is now in the board a full time. You've got all the acting CEOs. So if they've got an interest, bangakhombisa ikhono lokubhala for starters. Once they cannot write the questions that are being asked over there, so we'll help you even on the writing skills, if they can. So we take questions, you will write as many as the chair allows you to write, and then we will answer those questions. Honorable Phillips, Honorable Mylem, now Honorable Malinga, Honorable Mahlaule. For your, let me, okay, sorry, another wish. Just for your own ease of reference, I forgot, you will bear with me. Now you are sitting, people are asking, who are you, and they don't tell you. I'm Mr. Luzipo, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. Down there we've got Honorable Zungula, who is the chair. You? Oh, I nearly said he's the chair of the, but he's correct. Let me not call what he is. He's a member of this committee. I nearly said the president. So that they know that even here we do have president. We have got Honorable Kula, is a member of this committee. We have got Honorable Phillips, who is also a member of this committee. We've got Honorable Mylem. Oh, no, it's an English version, Mylem. It's not that it's strange that...
I'm sitting next to my brother.
His other name is Julius, so now there is that coincidence. Yeah. Why when Honorable Melam is looking at you, you then looked? We've got Honorable Mtenjane. Don't worry. Some of the things are not necessary for you to hear. Okay, we've got Honorable Mtenjane. We've got Honorable Hlonyana, ne? Okay. We've got Honorable Bilankulu. Honorable Malinga and Honorable Mahlaule, so that you know who are those members. Okay, Honorable Phillips.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have six questions to start with. The first question is on slide number 9. 16 are dormant, expired, completed. Can I please have a list of the projects that are actually completed? And then on page number 24, or slide number 24, costs due to the development of the common works, what is the cost estimated? And then costs due to transmission line, what is the cost estimate? And investment by South Africa in the construction, how much investment has been committed to by the South African government? And then on slide number 25, what is the final megawatt contribution to South Africa's grid when transmission losses are taken into consideration? And do we pay for the power distributed to South Africa or the power that we actually receive, excluding the distribution losses? Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I'd like to start from the foregrounding. On slide 15, on the SADC agreements, they talk about the development of the regional gas master plan and that it's underway. Perhaps this would be an opportune moment to ask, what is the status of our gas utilization master plan? Then, Chair, moving on to Grand Inga, the IRP suggests that we will receive power from Grand Inga in 2030. My question is, what is the likelihood of us actually receiving power from Grand Inga in 2030? My colleague has asked about various financial commitments. I just want to get some clarity. On slide 24, there's talk about the capital cost, and I'd like to know what that amounts to and what the transmission costs amount to. And then also, what have we actually committed going forward in each of the next three financial years? In rands, how much have we committed to Grand Inga going forward? How much has Eskom budgeted for Grand Inga in each of the next three financial years? What's on their budget forecast? Has any independent feasibility or viability assessment been conducted on Grand Inga? And if so, what was the outcome of that? What about a risk assessment? Has that been conducted? Particularly given that we are alerted to various social and environmental risks of the development on the people that live on the river itself and below the dam or below the existing dam. What penalties have been built into the agreement for non-supply or late supply of electricity? Then could we get some clarity? On slide 29, the last bullet point talks about awaiting the formal appointment of the joint consortium by the DRC comprising of combined Spanish and Chinese companies. It is my understanding that the Spanish and Chinese partners on this are in a state of disagreement and no longer wish to proceed with this project. Can we get some clarity on that? Then lastly, on Grand Inga, on slide 31, the first bullet point says that the SADC Energy Ministers meeting in June 2016 endorsed the Inga project. Then it says that in the next bullet point that there's an inter-utility memorandum of understanding for transmission solutions. This was back in 2016. We're now at the end of 2019. Why has that draft MOU for transmission solutions not been signed? What is holding up that process? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to the department, the CEOs, Chairpersons, and colleagues, and visitors. Chairperson, let me start by welcoming the report. It is indeed a very detailed report. Chairperson, there's a more balila, more questions before Opai directing. The first time we heard of the INGA project, we were told the slide that the acting CEO is talking about on the slide number 35, the explanation that they were 6 days late. Why didn't we get this information before? Because we were told that the minister, what was the hurry for the minister to sign the, I think they were there, but this explanation they are giving today, they did not give it to us. And now they say the project had already started. Why didn't they give that response when that question was asked to them? As for Petro SA Chair, we got information that we will be out of feedstock next year. I am looking at the slides here. The engagements to secure all this, the feedstock that will be needed in the country, started in 2015, and we are still in 2019.
Socio-economic overview on the international aspect. So we are coming to the first question. I don't know whether you are going to be the next
Ozansizo Phillips. Chairperson, let me also applaud the explanation or clarity that we got from the chairperson of SEF, that all the Hollywood thing will come to an end soon, because in 2 weeks' time you'll be starting with the interviews. We are going to hold you to that. I heard that you're a doctor. I don't want to hear the doctor. Dr. Monde. We hope that directors, you will appoint you will advise the minister to appoint people who will take this matter seriously, because you can see that we are seated with a serious challenge in terms of securing supply of energy in the country, running the subsidiaries of the department. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Chair. We want to first welcome the presentation. It's quite informative. And taking from what Honorable Malinga left is that we can see progress from day 1, 2, 3, and 4, and probably 5. There is serious progress. We are hoping that we'll get things right. But because we are obsessed with progress, Chair, I would want to go to slide 26 so that we occupy ourselves with moving on. Okay, I have it. So if I don't see that, I'll assume that people have it. There's a map there, Chair, that demonstrate how the line. I just forgot the term you used. Of electricity, and I'm stopping because I'm speaking on his presentation. He mentioned that they are still thinking of seeing the possibility of supplying other countries along the way from DRC to South Africa. What's there to think of? Does it make sense to just jump everybody who may be needing electricity and not supply them with electricity so that you make sure that you take an opportunity to be commercially viable when you are selling electricity towards South Africa? To me, thinking about it already does not make business sense, but actioning it will make business sense. It's a long way, 3,700 kilometers, passing all these countries that may need electricity. You don't sell to them. It doesn't make sense to me. Now, in the spirit of moving forward, I just want to understand the rationale of still thinking about it and not actioning it in your plans. That is the only question, Chair, I have on Grand Inga. I must confess that I also suffer from what Comrade Malinga is suffering from. When we write questions, we sometimes link them with the with other comments that have been made, so it becomes very difficult to isolate them. And I can see this is a practice from the chair, it's collapsing us.
Your earlier official grievance is noted. relax. It gives you an opportunity to even come back later on. As a point of reference, so you won't forget it forever. DG Netimbalak.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll indicate, Chair, that we have a technical team that is also involved on the Inga project, and with your permission, if you can allow them to comment. I know that Gareth has been leading on the presentation, but I would like them to also reflect on some of the technical questions that have been raised. Amongst those present is Thabang Wadat, who is part of the established committees that work with Inga, who joined us a little bit late this morning. Chair, on my side, maybe I can confirm on one question that has been raised about proceeding with the project with the consortia that was procured through the DRC Congo. First, let me state that it was a process that was done by DRC Congo. And as we stand at the moment, there's no reason to doubt from our side, from our technical side and engagement, that the project will continue. It is correct, as a normal course of business, that there were issues that the two consortia needed to deal with, in particular with regard to their financial modeling of the project. However, there's not been a negative reflection not to proceed with the project from our engagement with them from our South African side. That I can confirm, Chair. However, it is correct that there are issues that they were busy with, and those issues, as far as we are concerned, are being ironed out to make sure this project continues as planned. You would have seen in the presentation different phases that has been agreed upon. If there's a delay in phase one or phase two or phase three, it could be because of those issues being ironed out. But there's never a negative insofar as proceeding with the project, as it were. I will let Gareth or Tawang to deal with other issues that have been raised. Chair, if they're not covered, I'll come back to deal with some of them. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair, Honourable Members, DG. In fact, most of the very specific questions around the Grand Inca itself are some of the more technical questions. So I will just deal with the one that relates to the or two specific issues that were raised with regards to the more general part of the presentation. We would be able to share the specifics around the 16 expired, dormant, or completed, because they would vary depending on. I made an example, for instance, of a specific project-based one that was an agreement with the Kingdom of Norway around petroleum industry-related training that had a particular time frame when it was done. It expired, but we keep record because it was an official memorandum of agreement between the two countries. So I think, with the indulgence of the Honourable Member and the Chair, we will be able to, in a written form, respond and give information on all the 16 that we referred to. With regards to the Inga specifically, the issue with regards to the MOU, basically, I mean, the question was, I think, from Honourable Milam, related to the time lapse between endorsement of the project by SADC, energy ministers, and the draft MOU. The process of negotiating a memorandum of agreement in the context of government just between two countries in itself is a sometimes a challenge, because it's affected by a range of factors on both sides. In some cases, issues of change of government, issues of elections, and so on. Just like we would have that transition period, other countries have the same. So one can imagine when you have five countries around the table. So there's been drafts exchanged. It's not as if nothing has been going on. The issue is ultimately coming to a point of an agreement, but then also in the context of, as we have stated, our efforts to try and ensure that this mega project, referring to the Grand Inga, actually has regional economic and industrial impact. When other countries offer to join or make approaches to join, like in the case of Angola and Namibia, you actually have to now consider that also. Now it affects the original discussion. So you have had that engagement and exchanges of drafts and so on. Ultimately, when we realize that there is a challenge with regards to progress, we actually formally requested through SADC, requested the sub support from the sub-secretariat as well as SADC to then try and push forward that process, which is now at the point, as we've indicated, where we are supposed to we have offered to host the meeting. DRC will convene as the leader with regards to this particular project during the coming period, Chair. So there is a work that has been going on. It is a challenge. Unrelated, South Sudan, for instance, Chair, the agreement that we signed, intergovernmental agreement that we signed last year in September, the minister, negotiations around that agreement started in 2014-15 financial year. So you have that particular challenge across. I don't think it's only related to Inga only. So those two specifically, Chair, I will give to my colleague Tabango that to deal with the more technical questions that deals with the cost of works and transmission and those related questions, Chair. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, members. I will deal with the technical content of the questions in relation to the Grand Inga project. But perhaps before I start, just to outline the approach in the Inga project. The government of DRC had issued a procurement process to procure developers. And the approach is that all the developers that would be procured
will be responsible for the construction of the dam as well as the transmission line within DRC. So as a country, we will not incur any capital costs in relation to the construction of the dam and the transmission line within DRC. Now, from the border of DRC, in relation to the cost for the transmission line, there are two options as presented that we are exploring. And we'll get to the final option, Chair, because we're still at feasibility stage in relation to transmission evacuation option. One option is to evacuate power from DRC into the SADC region, and South Africa through Eskom possibly will trade that power. The second option is to evacuate power from DRC all the way to South Africa. So those are the two options that we're exploring. Once we have reached a settlement on an option, then we'll be able to do detailed studies and develop the costs related to evacuation from DRC into the SADC region. So currently we can't give you an exact figure of the transmission element that is responsible for South Africa. The power that will be delivered in South Africa, we are going to agree on a tariff. There will be so many cents per kilowatt hour that South Africa will commit to pay. Obviously, we pay on delivery. If they deliver 2,500, we multiply that by the tariff, and that's how much we'll pay. If they pay, they deliver anything less, that's how much we'll pay. There is a reserve margin as part of the studies that Eskom will make available for the gap. If there's any gap, for whatever reason, we make sure that there's enough reserve margin within our system. The 2030 delivery timeline, and it's a quite a sensitive issue that we have raised with GRC, that at some point we need to draw the line as a country. The expected construction time is 7 years for phase one of the project. Now, if you look at 2030 minus 7 years, 2023, which means by 2023 there should be construction started on site, failing which then South Africa will reserve its right. We have raised it with DRC. The treaty itself makes provision for 10 years. It was signed in 2013. It lapses 2023. If nothing happens, in other words, if there's no phase one, the treaty then automatically lapses. So yes, we have made that safeguard. That's why it's 2030 in the IRP, that will be able to make a decision for an alternative by 2023 if there's no movement from DRC. So the capital cost, we're not responsible for the construction of that. The budget, the only budget that has been made available is the operation budget for the office that is established to manage the project on behalf of South Africa. And that's the only cost that South Africa will incur during construction. Eskom, from Eskom's side, they have a team that deals with SADC region. Warm bodies have been allocated to also focus on DRC. So there is no specific set-aside budget for the next 3 years. Honorable Malem. The feasibility, yes, this was done. It was done by DRC, pre-feasibility followed by feasibility, which led to the RFP, which was issued, resulting in the shortlisting of the two consortiums, as mentioned. So the feasibility is available. It's not a property of South Africa. It was done by DRC, but it can be made available if that is requested from them. The penalties for non-supply. It's a take or pay. If you don't deliver, you don't get paid, as simple as that. There is no firm commitment that will pay if there is nothing delivered. So it is in the interest of the developer that they deliver the power for them to be able to service their loans. And the Spanish and the Chinese no longer wishing to continue. DG has responded to that, but we can rest assured that there are discussions between the two consortiums, and the intention is very clear that they are willing to continue on the project. They need to sort out their own arrangements to form a joint proposal. But they have confirmed that the project is still going ahead. The IG MOU, look, before you finalize on a transmission solution, you need to get a confirmation first that the 2023 timeline has been met. Thereafter, you can then say, okay, the transmission solution is this option. Because if you run ahead of the generation part of the project, you are likely to incur costs which, if the project doesn't happen, if the generator doesn't come on board, then we would have incurred a fruitless and wasteful expenditure in relation to the transmission detailed option. So that's why we decided that let's delay the transmission, the finalization of the transmission work, until we can get firm certainty that the project will indeed happen. I think I've answered all the questions, Chair, the technical questions that is to the project.
Umageva is taking the power. We said and I will find a space on for power. I will not refuse. I'm not sure. I want us to pass, but I don't want us to pass just for the sake of it. On the on this answer that you are giving, you see, you've got 2030. You've got 2023, which is 2023 would have been 10 years, if I'm correct. You had started with this project from a vision, whatever it is, in 2008. 10 years. 10. By 2023. 10. Now, this is 2019. I want to hear, because sometimes English is very difficult, especially for a ruralitarian like me. Now, 2023, your agreement, if there's nothing that is on the table, your agreement comes to an end. Now, an irresponsible person like me, just for these few minutes, says, why do you have to be constrained by timelines of an agreement? Because the agreement is just a broad guide. My fear, let me be honest, is that you proceed with something just for the sake of making it to 2023. I'm not saying it can't happen. I was just worried with the submission, because it says something to me that in the 5 years' time, that's why I said, allow me to be reckless for the sake of these few minutes. That if I stand up and say, is it worth it? Should I wait for 10 years to finish and say, no, it's not a project that is worth going forward with? If I had it, that's why I was listening to say, we will only make a decision. Let me put it like that. We only make a decision in 2023. I can tell you, in the first 2, 3, 4 years, I can see whether am I pursuing something. So if I can be clarified on this thing, because sometimes part of my criticism of public service is that some of the things we are not fast to see. I'm not saying there's no value for the project, please understand me correctly. But I will fear a situation where we say, hey, in 2023 we have seen that this has not delivered to what is expected, and therefore we are withdrawing from it. So if please clarify that first part. Two, it means 6 years. 6 years, we are negotiating. We are trying to find a solution. In 6 years, we can't come up with concrete estimates. First, the formula of transmission. If I got you, you said you are still deciding whether it's direct DRC, direct to South Africa, and so forth, and looking also on. By the way, now I understand, see, when there is a rejoiner, there is a potential that where you were before, you take some steps backward to go and connect with those who are behind, which sometimes is necessary.
Now, if for the 6 years we can't talk about a quantified financial, I want to put it crudely in general terms, quantified financial implications of the project, both in terms of its primary delivery objectives, but also in terms of the overall expectation. Now, what are the key? Because that is, to me, becomes fundamental. What then will become the key determinant of proceeding or non-proceeding with the project by 2023? Because you say, I assume if construction is expected to start in 2023 or by 2023 there should have been the first phase, the risk is very high that that first phase may commence and encourage us to proceed because now there's something. And the second phase and the third phase becomes the West. Now you've already started with the project. So that's why, please, I said one of the things I would say sitting from here is that there must be something that's worth, that's why I said I'm not talking about the project, that's worth continuing with. I can tell you, for me, I calculate even the fact that somebody has to not perform something in the office. That's how, for me, my calculated costs are. That not to perform any other work in the office because it's working on this project. And having worked in this project for 10 years, we realized it was a project that... So let's assume you've got something in the department you're supposed to be doing, but now this is the work that you're supposed to do. It means first, what you should have been doing suffers by pursuing a project that down the line, we may find that it was not necessarily a project to pursue. And at this stage, in my view, technically, it seems we cannot be able to say this is what it is worth technically to perform. I want us to just help for a ruralitarian, a layman person who doesn't understand some of these technical economic concepts or financial concepts of the project. Because to me, I would have assumed part of project management would have said, this is the project, phase one is going to be this, this is what has to be done, and based on what is supposed to be done, this is what could be the cost implications. And at the final end of the product, this is what we think would have been able by projection, so that even your cost of transmission are able to talk to the... The major criticism could be the fact that there are gaps in between the first and the final stage. But I don't want to close, honorable members, who would have wanted to have follow-up. Any follow-up, honorable Mailam?
It's not a follow-up. It's two questions that weren't answered. The one related to the gas utilization master plan, and the second related to the social and environmental risks.
Thank you, Chair. Tabang will deal with the gas utilization plan because it's part of our program. Chair, the slide 30, it's trying to reflect on what needs to be done moving forward. But I would request if Tabang, you do have that information that we have shared when we're engaging with stakeholders, that reflect the phases of the project from phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, because that is helping us, Chair, to deal with the timelines that you are making reference to, and we are absolutely correct. We cannot wait until 2023, then it's only then that we'll be able to see whether the project is moving forward or not. But unfortunately, 2023, it's an agreement in treaty. So in other words, we have an obligation to make sure that by 2023, something is happening. But we are not going to wait until 10/23. What we'll be doing as government and the DOE representing government is to then monitor the progress that is being made on the phases the phases that are applicable in the project itself, clearly outline what needs to be done by which time on phase one, on phase two, on phase three. So that provides us a much more in-depth analysis to be able to forecast our analysis for future and be able to make the necessary decisions. Chair, you will also appreciate that we've made reference to IRP, which has already been government approved by cabinet. Remember, some of the assumptions we have made in the IRP are also informed by the delivery of this project on the phases that have been outlined. The most unfortunate comment to make and the questions raised, Chair, is that some of the work that needs to be done, as it appears on slide 30, is the one that will quantify, particularly the studies and the engagement with the countries that we have identified who are willing to participate in this particular project, to then be able to quantify based on the assumptions on the tariffs at the time. So that becomes a little bit of a challenge for us. But in terms of the project itself and deliverables as they appear in different phases, it does give us a sense of knowing what's happening. And that will also call upon us. That's why we always say the integrated resource plan is a dynamic document that is also dependent on the deliverables that have been committed by important stakeholders such as ESCOM and projects of this nature moving forward. So that's what will help. The 10-year period is a treaty period and is compulsory for us to meet. If we are to change anything from the treaty, it requires a very long process to do so, and that's not our intention. Our intention is to make sure that the implementation phases as outlined and agreed by stakeholders are met, and we monitor that. Unfortunately, that slide is not here, Chair, but we can provide that information in writing to yourself and through the members that reflects what we expect on phase one to happen on phase two, on phase three, on phase four, and phase five. And we are monitoring that. As a matter of fact, the technical team from DOE time to time engages with the implementation steering committees that have been established to make sure that those phases are met. I know, Chair, I'm not helping that much in terms of the exact detail, but high level, that's what it is, and that's what we are monitoring. We have also made it very clear, Chair, just to go back to the issue that has been raised by Honorable Milan, that the failure of the consortium to resolve their issues on time affects the implementation of the phases already agreed upon. And it's in our interest to make sure that happens and is done on time. The delay impacts directly. We have also informed them that not only the implementation of the project, but our own integrated resource plan will have a net effect impact if that is done. So that's why we work with them very closely to make sure that whatever delays they are faced with, they must resolve them because it's in our interest. But at the right time, when we don't see progress, we will then have a duty and a responsibility to decisively intervene and come with different mechanisms of dealing with the gap that could be created by that. I'm not sure if I can hand over to Thabang just to deal with gas utilization plan. Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thabang?
Thanks, DG. The draft utilization master plan was developed. It was released, shared with the public, but what then led to its delay was that we felt the electricity part of it needed to be done thoroughly. That's why we waited for the IRP to be finalized. There is currently about 3,500 megawatts of gas to power in the IRP. We are now working on resuscitating the utilization master plan, giving due regards to the IRP input so that the plan covers not only the gas side, but it's also the electricity side. The work has started internally, and we'll be releasing the updated version of the document. Chair, that was part of the feasibility study that was done, because the site physically is located in DRC. So the social and environmental impact is in the DRC study that was done as part of the preparation for the project. The documents, Chair, as I've said, we are not custodian of those documents because the procurer is a sovereign state in the DRC. But I'm sure the information can be shared on request.
Chair, I think that covers, but with your permission, Chair, maybe to the most important clarity is to reflect on the phases of implementation for the members. Then you'll be able to effectively exercise your oversight on the project, as we are doing technically as a DOE. We can share that information with you. It is available.
Exactly. That's where my issue was. It was not, even on the treaty, I was not opposed to the treaty. I was just saying there are certain things that by projections and the pace you go, by the time you reach there, you can try and comply with the treaty by waiting until it expires. But also it doesn't mean, I'm just saying, there are many scenarios so that at least there is a common understanding that if this one, I'm not saying that's the case, so that you don't come back here and say, but you never said, if this it doesn't go in this way, we will intervene, but we'll expect to be reconsidered when that we made this contribution, regardless of what is allocated to us. Maybe this is how we'll recoup our contribution to fast-track the process. So I was just saying that, so that you don't wait and then we say, in 2023, we had to do this in order to speed up the process. But I understand. Honorable members, can we go to the next one now? Let me be fair because of that grievance from Ms. Meinir Mashaule. I allow you members to talk to all of them. The only thing I will cut you, I will cut the numbers depending on the questions asked, so that we don't forget the first question or a middle question. The best way to sometimes to avoid questions is to pretend that you've not had another question. Okay? Any take on the rest of what is left? Honorable Mashaule? Okay. You will speak, all of you, except the one who has not raised his hand or her hand. All of you this side. Just the one who's next to you, when he's finished speaking, speak. I will tell you where to stop.
Thanks, Chair. Just two issues. The first one on South Sudan. There is a question that keeps coming up when we speak about South Sudan. And because it keeps coming up, one had to go back to some legacy reports and documents to understand what exactly is it that went wrong. And it's about the signing of an agreement on the 6th of May, when elections are on the 8th of May. Now, I don't want to say my findings are correct, but would I be correct to say it is the intergovernmental agreement between SA and South Sudan that was signed in 2018 September and not the commercial agreement? The commercial agreement is the one that was signed on the 6th of May 2019. I'm raising this because the clarity you can give, if my conclusion is correct, it then deals with the notion that some ruling party minister just woke up feared that they may lose elections on the 8th, went to sign some agreement so that even if we lose elections, the agreement is signed and it's binding to the next coming government. Would I be correct to arrive to this conclusion? That is the first question. The second point I want to make, Chair, is related to slide 16, bullet point number 2. access to assets to diversify sources of supply for oil, engagements with the following countries at various levels, and they are named there. I think this point, Chair, supports the earlier point I made in the last portfolio committee meeting that, and the minister made it, that there is not much value in expanding the relations in terms of the oil sources in countries like your Russia, America, and all of that, leaving Africa that has once demonstrated that they can bring 51% of crude oil to South Africa, and I named them to say they are in your annual report 2018-2019, where Nigeria provided 33%, Angola 12%, Ghana 5%, Togo 1%, the total of 51%, meaning we are, if we expand our relations with the rest of the African continent, we are in the right track to rely on African sources for crude oil, to avoid what I called yesterday, last week, throwing toys of America and China amongst each other, and then we suffer in terms of prices. And I think I want to emphasize the point that the department should go ahead and forge ahead with the relations with other African countries that have got this crude oil in abundance, so that we lessen reliability to those who, when they sneeze, we catch the flu. At least here in Africa, there's not much sneezing except when some people wake up with hatred to other African brothers. It's the only thing we discuss in Africa, and I think we are well capable to deal with that, unlike what is happening in between China and America, where we don't live, by the way. I just wanted to make that point, that let's expand the relations in the rest of the African continent, so that our reliability on energy is within the African continent. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I had already said my first point on this one. I am on Petro SA. Given the processes that have started, Chair, and the fact that the entity or the subsidiary knows that by 2020 they will be out of feedstock, I am worried, Chairperson, on the snail pace since they have started with the engagements, because 2020 is a month away from now. Chairperson, if you can check slide 48. Petro SA and Rosgio entered into a memorandum of understanding on the 9th of March 2015 to explore areas of possible cooperation. While in 2019, nothing has been done. On the last slide, Chair, they say Rosgio was selected as the preferred bidder having followed competitive process. The last bullet point says Petro SA Rosgio meeting in November 2019 to revitalize the relationship. Revitalize means that the relationship was no longer there. So 2015 to 2019, nothing was happening, according to my understanding. I might be wrong, Chair. Also, the slides that are not numbered, I think the one with the Petro SA farm out strategy. Financial impact, Chair, it's worrisome. Number one, potential investment of some 5 billion. Some does not give you that they are sure that we will get investment of 5 billion. Chairperson, also on slide where they quoted that the president, same slide, that the president talked of or spoke of Ocean's Economy Project Pakisa to drill 30 wells in the period of 2014 to 2024. So far, according to my understanding, no well has been dug as well since the pronunciation of this. But on their slide 39, they have 48 million to start drilling, or am I confusing issues here, Chair? To start drilling six wells. Are they late or are they far ahead? I think that's where I'll end for now, Chair. Oh, at some point we were told that Total abandoned some drilling. I think this committee we were assist with that. But I heard the acting CEO talking about they want to go there. I think it's block 9 and 11. Did he say they are also competing with Total? If maybe I did not catch him correctly. Where they identified block 9 and block 11A. Remember, we also asked that why did the department waste 14 million in drilling where they did not find anything? Are they returning to the same block where Total now also is interested in? That would be my question, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Well, my questions are very simple and straightforward. The first question, Chairperson, is I would like to know who will own the refinery once it's completed. And then secondly, who will own the pipeline that they're proposing once it's finalized. And then on the issue of the forestry, as much as I'm a fighter, but I love the environment, I would like to understand once the refinery is completed, what measures are they going to put in place to compensate the forestry that was touched during the period. And then when Dr. Nyande was presenting, he spoke about the 3-year delay with the Rosco. So I just wanted to understand why was that delay there for 3 years? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair. Chairperson, this issue of actually there are a lot of other issues that are questionable here, especially in this issue of the South Sudan deal. As much as my colleague raised the point that indeed the signing of that agreement is also questionable a little bit there because of the timing and everything. And then when you go deeper in the very same issue, when they were signing that agreement, in between there was a gentleman here who is a very much known fraudster. The man, he goes by many names. I think he's got about three identical names. Ayub, Ayong, NJ Ayub, and Job Ayub. Those are all his names. And I understand the man was also in prison when they were signing these deals in South Sudan. So here, as a committee, remember, this committee is representing the interest of South Africans, which are the people who sent us to come and represent them here. So we cannot necessarily question issues here which are questionable and then just leave it like that. Because the signing, the minister, the then minister, when he went to sign the deal, as my colleague is correctly saying, the timing there was towards election and all those things, why was the rush? That will be the question that we are asking ourselves here. And then also people who were involved in the signing of those kind of deals, people who are known fraudsters with different names and all those things. So as a committee, we are questioning this issue. for record, so that it must be known that we will not necessarily allow questionable things to happen right in under our nose. I hope we will get clarity as we move on, and also that we, like last time, I remember as we were asking a question last time, as to say, why would SEF be the one who's signing that deal of Sudan instead of Petro SA? Because for record, we know that Petro SA is the one that was supposed to have signed that deal instead of SEF. That also is very much questionable. And then further, we would like to know that in these 6 years, if I'm correct, in this 6 years deal, what will be the benefit of the South Africans? Because remember, in South Africa, we also have artisans, people who are capable to can go and participate in the building of those refineries and those pipelines. So what are the South African citizens in a form of artisans are going to benefit also in this project? Because they need also to benefit, to get something out of this thing. And then last time also, I remember we had we hear that as much as all of us, we know that South Sudan, or Sudan for that matter, those are areas which are infested with civil wars and all those things. And then last time, for cost cutting, I understand that the pipeline has to pass through Sudan, if I'm correct. And then there was a fight. There's no proper relationship with South Sudan, with that other country. I want to check there, how far is that? Did you a follow up on that one? If the cost cutting, if the pipe gonna go through that other country, which you said it was not in good terms with the original South Sudan, or what did you do there? Can you clarify us there? As to, did you engage something there too, so that we can then reduce some unnecessary cost for that pipeline? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. I find it very interesting that Honourable Mtanjane is repeating all the questions that I asked in the last meeting when SFF were here. Chair, let me start with Petro SA. First of all, on slide 39, the first bullet point talks about capital commitments for the exploration phase will be funded from internal cash resources. Can we get a figure as to what those capital commitments are and what they will cover? Then, this is a long-standing bone of contention that I've had with the department and Mr. Moache with SFF. Where is the EPSA? I asked for it. I submitted a PIA application for it. You committed in writing to getting back to me by the end of October. I haven't got it. So where is this agreement? I'd like to see the actual physical agreement between South Africa and South Sudan. Moving on to Saudi Aramco, there's some confusion between the chairperson I'm not sure if it was the chairperson or the DG and the acting CEO of CEF as to the number of jobs that will be created. Someone said 21,000 and then the CEO said 23,000 during the construction phase. I'd like some clarity as to that. I'd also like some clarity as to a report that there is a conflict between Transnet and the department as to the best place for this production facility. I understand that Transnet are keen on pushing Kucha and that DMRE is obviously firmly of the opinion that it should be Richards Bay. So I'd like some clarity as to where we stand on that. Uh, Mr. Sono, you spoke about the lack of investment by the private sector in refinery capacity. So clearly there is no appetite by the private sector to invest in upgrading or building new refineries, either because it costs too much or there is insufficient demand, or, and probably the most likely, there is policy or regulatory or political instability in the market, and so there is no desire by the private sector to invest. Which then brings me to why, as government, are you willing to risk it in such an unstable environment? And then, if I can just end off on Ross Geo, Chairperson, there is, let me just find the slides here. So, my first comment is, there was a lot of mention made about how this Ross Geo exploration is going to result in feedstock for the Mosgas PetroSA facility, which we all know and we've heard repeatedly is going to run out of stock by December 2020. What worries me is that on the slide that says South Coast investment potential and it has a timeline on it, field development up to first gas is scheduled for 2025-2026. If we're going to run out by December 2020, this is not going to sort out that problem. So I'd like to understand why we are pushing this as a solution to PetroSA's refinery feedstock problem, because I don't see it as a solution at all. I really don't understand that. The second issue that I have is that in terms of the farm-out agreement, PetroSA has committed to purchasing gas at a cost of $7 per MMBTU and reselling it to CEF at that price. The current spot market price is around $2.90 per MMBTU, give or take. Let's say $3.50. It's still half the price of what we are committing to buy this for. So I don't understand that part of the financials. Why are we buying gas at twice the price if we could buy it from anyone else in the world? Why are we going into an investment that's going to cost us way more to get the gas that we need? My last question relates to the liability for decommissioning, which rests entirely on PetroSA. And I'd like to know how much that is estimated to cost and where PetroSA, which already has problems with its decommissioning liability, is going to find the money. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine is actually just a question on policy and if the one hand actually talks to the other. On slide 11, we go, the priority is given to energy projects that have a regional impact and deepen regional integration. And then when we go to our farm out process, there we find that for some weird reason, Ross Geo are given preference over an indigenous Nigerian oil and gas company, which submitted a bid under SL South Africa. So do we have a policy that works when it's convenient, and then when it's not convenient, we change it, or do we have a constant policy? And what were the overriding factors that made Ross Geo so attractive to go with? Thanks very much.
No, Agabali Ganga Slano. He said I must inform you that Tune interview in 20 minutes time. No. Because our boys was Buzela. No, they are Bulela Slano. On page 35, I see on your business development effort that we have acquired the service of a London based company, PetroVision. are there no firms in the country, region or continent that specializes in petroleum exploration and production auditing? Why did you have to opt for PetroVision? You speak, second question is that you speak to this Block 2 as a viable investment opportunity and that it has the, is a significant value to both SSF and South Africa. Can you quantify this value? I think, Chair, it's important to go deeper into the question of South Sudan, that the conflict has been taking place for over 5 years now, notwithstanding that it has displaced a number of people, there are a number of people that have died in that country as a result of the conflict that is ensuing. How safe is our investment? One of the obstacles that stands in the way of peace in South Sudan is the question of borders of state, whether it's 10 or 32. This has caused problems around questions of appropriation and ownership of land in that particular country. Can you be able to give the portfolio committee assurance that our investment will not be affected by this? And I think you are mindful of the fact that there is a pending transitional government in South Sudan that was supposed to have been sworn in on the 12th of November this month. With that in mind, where does it place the investment put by SFF in relation to Block 2? Over the weekend, I was going through an article on Mail and Guardian regarding the refinery titled Giant New Refinery. They say it's either a curse or a boon. And I think it is a boon, Chair. And investment such as this one should be commended, not questioned, in my own view, Chairperson. Because I think they will change the dynamics of oil around the country. Which is one thing that we have been saying, that government ought to play a key and strategic role in the economy. And this investment speaks directly to that, so that we don't have to rely on these monopolies to run our own economy. So my questions would be, Chair, that what will be the impact of this new refinery on job security at other refineries? I think we are mindful of the fact that there is a move towards electric cars in the not only in the country but in the globe, which is a growing phenomenon. How will this impact on the long-term sustainability of this refinery? For instance, if certain the world is going to that particular direction and we are going in a certain direction. Yeah, the last question, Chair, is that with this new refinery and all other existing ones, what will be the impact on climate change, Chair? And on a lighter note, I was saying that the reason why Honorable Mchenjana asked the same question as Honorable Maidam is that that's what happens when you are sometimes in a coalition. Thank you very much, Chair.
Don't spoil my meeting, please.
Thank you, Chair. The Chair spoke about the projects that have been implemented slowly. And he made an indication that this time around the projects will be and they'll be done at a more
point of order. No, it's about the previous speaker. Yeah, it's really out of order, way out of order. That is the reason why you come late in the meetings. You come here, say something. Sure.
Yeah. So I was saying, what will be done to make sure that these, what will be done differently? Because it did indicate that the projects now will be done at a more faster pace, but we don't understand previously why were they done at a slower pace. Secondly, now, what will be done differently? The second question is relation to the Ross-Geo partnership with PetroSA. I just need to understand what are the arrangements as well as agreements in place for skills transfers for the benefit of the local citizens of our country. And currently, according to the current current arrangements, how is the balance between the local and the foreign labor force? And lastly, when do you preempt that the country will be able to explore gas without needing multinationals, companies, as well as foreign skills to do the work? Then the last question is on the cooperation with the Russian Federation. I note there that Ernst & Young was appointed as transaction advisors. Who did the appointment? Is it the Russian Federation or is it South Africa? If it's South Africa, why Ernst & Young? Is there no South African company that could have been appointed as the transaction advisors? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sure that the colleagues presented on three items will be better positioned to reflect on some of the issues raised. Just to maybe deal with one policy issue, unless if I did not understand exactly through you, Chair, what Honorable Mylan was saying about the decision regarding the oil refinery in terms of its location. I don't know whether my question is that the question through you, Chair.
I think the issue is sort of clarity on the report that there is a okay in inverted commas, a disagreement between DMT, MRE,
okay,
and Transnet on the location of the
refinery. Thank you, Chair.
One being the Pucha for Transnet, the other one is from the MRE.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe to assist from the, obviously I'll be talking from a DMRE perspective, Chair. I cannot speak on the perspectives of other entities and their studies they might have conducted and eventually arrive at different preferences. But from the DOE perspective, Chair, the policy position has always been that the focus for oil refinery will be the Richards Bay, and the feasibility studies were done to that effect, and the rationale has been presented. If a much more needed information is required to that effect, we could provide that, and the honorable principals, both previous and current, have pronounced on that. So from a DMRE position, there is no ambiguity. The strategic decision was that UHA then, in terms of support for what they're doing, will be LNG gas. That's what we'll be focusing on. And recently you would have witnessed also the opening and the launching of another gas project in UHA as part of the policy position that the MRE has provided. I'm not sure other entities, unfortunately, I can't speak on their behalf, but that is the current position that in our department and the government at large have been focusing on. And as we speak, and as colleagues have presented, the work is going on along those lines in those respective areas. And Chair, with your permission, I would request the Chairperson to guide on how to handle some of the issues that relate to SAF Group as a whole. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. My response on a number of questions that have been asked would probably be theoretical more than practical, as I was not there before. But I have been, and we have as a board and the new board, been apprised of the past history of the institution. And definitely the mistakes that have been made, and definitely the advances that have been made. And our resolve, answering the question, the last, that what is going to be implemented now and why the implemented was slow, I cannot answer that, but to say that as a board we came with one aim, and the aim is that we don't look at the past, even though the past can be able to forecast the future. We look at the current, and from the current we move on with optimism to make sure that this institution, SAF, as a group, it succeeds. We stick on the practical side of it and the scientific evidence that is in front of us and move forward. And therefore, we come with that seal. We don't want to draw on the past. That is what on the breach or investigation will continue to go forward. So I will ask the CEO of PetroSA and the CEO of SFF, most of which these questions have been directed to really go on the technical side of answering the questions. We want to go with partnerships. There is no national oil company in the world that has done and grown and succeeded without partnerships. This does not mean that we have to lose our sovereignty. The idea is for us to grow. The idea for us is to make sure that we employ people and we take money to the fiscus rather than draw money from the fiscus for projects that will not work. We will not do that. That is our idea, and that is where we start things from. So we should not doubt us from that perspective. On the questions of lack investments, technically an economic investment is a form of comes after savings. The countries that have savings and access savings, they will bring us, they will bring that money to countries where they know that they will get the rates of return. And in the process, we must also benefit from the rate of return that the countries have from their savings. So definitely they will come with their investment, they will get their rate of return, and will benefit in terms of employment, in terms of also getting access. At the end of it all, who will own these institutions? It's South Africans, and it's the South African government. So with those few comments, there is no, I think you've had the CEO, he will speak for himself, wrongly when you say that there is no desire to invest or for investors to invest in this project, in particular on the South Sudan. I think that is contrary to what he had said. There are many people who want to come with us and partner in that block, that is B2. It's a question of us making a decision of which one will be financially viable for us and affordable, and definitely at the end of it all, we will all benefit in the process and we will grow. So I think that's the correction that I could make on that. But on the other questions, my colleagues, which I would start with PetroSA, I think it was covered in the presentation, the date of the election and the date of the signing of the thing. But I would ask Mr. Mwahi and Mr. Saidini to make a contribution to the other questions that I did not allude to. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Chair, SAF Chair as well as Committee Chair. I will respond to the questions related to the PetroSA RosGEO potential partnership. Questions, I guess, from Honorable Malinga relate to the potential partnership between RosGEO and PetroSA has been long coming since 2015, and nothing has really happened, or nothing tangible has really come out thereof. And that is worrisome, and particularly given that PetroSA may be running out of gas at the end of next year, Honorable Malinga's words.
Yes, indeed, it's unfortunate that this process has taken so long. It has indeed taken very, very long. Ordinarily, a farm-out process is concluded within 6 to 12 months. And it's 3 years later, and this partnership has not yet been concluded. A number of factors have contributed to that. A key contributor was the parties were not finding one another in terms of the actual negotiation. So Petro SA Rosgio have had to negotiate commercial terms in terms of the farm-out agreement, and the parties were not finding one another. I'll make an example on the gas price, for example. There was a certain price that Rosgio expected, which Petro SA tried to negotiate down. And there are various other commercial terms that the parties were negotiating, not finding one another, which then meant the negotiations are taking longer than is necessary. The turnover of ministers in terms of energy ministers has also not assisted, because linked to negotiations is international travel and robust engagements in relation to the negotiations. So there has been delays, and sometimes there has been delays in terms of international travel and approval on the basis that a new minister would need to acquaint themselves with this potential partnership, be comfortable with it before they could take a decision in relation to approvals for international travel. We've had four or so ministers, starting with Minister Tina Chomat, Mamoloko Kubai, Minister Masobo, Minister Khadebe, and then now the latest minister. But I think in the main is, the negotiations themselves have also not been smooth. And I guess some of the terms that may be in favor of Rosgio are being raised by this very committee. Honorable Milem, for example, we've had to push back very hard on some of these terms. Honorable Malinga again says we seem not to be sure in terms of the potential investment in relation to this deal. We say some 5 billion. I guess by some 5 billion, there is a firm offer in terms of $359 million that was made by Rosgio, in essence covering an exploration work program that also has about 6 wells to be drilled. Why we approximate is because the offer is in dollars, and with the rand-dollar exchange rate fluctuations, you can never say with certainty it is 5 billion. It depends on the rand-dollar exchange rate at a particular point in time. But the firm offer is $359 million. Then there's a question linked to that. We wanted part of the national imperatives to unlock the ocean economy, where Project Pakisa aims for the drilling of 10 wells in a 10-year time period from 2014 to 2024. And so the question was, have any wells been drilled in advance of that national imperative? No, in terms of this deal, no wells have been drilled, because no wells could be drilled before we've concluded the deal. There is an offer to drill 6 wells, but none of those wells have been drilled on the basis that the negotiations have not yet been concluded. Then there's a question in relation to is the Rosgio, I guess Rosgio Petro SA partnership, looking into going into the block that Total is in. So is there some sort of a competition with Total? No. This potential partnership is looking at what is called Exploration Right 61, which covers Block 9 and 11A. Total are in Block 11B, 12B. So they are in a block next door to this block. Okay, so there's a question, Honorable Milem. Rosgio deal will result in feedstock by, I guess, by 2025, 2026, but PetroSA is running out of gas by the end of next year. When this deal started, remember the deal, we went out on the farm-out process in 2015 and deal and we received offers in by 29th April 2016. So we had envisaged that then that this deal would really help PetroSA augment its feedstock supply. A lot of time has passed since then. So here we are still reflecting to an extent, okay, we've now moved timelines to reflect if this deal was to be closed now, what the implication would be. But that is really talking to the exploration work program that was proposed by Rosgeo. It would indeed not necessarily give us gas in time now. But I have recently traveled to Moscow, and in terms of the discussions we had, that was in October of this year, so it's last month, both parties recognize the fact that this deal, the initial proposal might have to be modified to take into account the fact that PetroSA might need feedstock much sooner. So what is now in discussions between the parties is that let's look at, I guess Sef-Chair has made reference to this, let's look at production optimization, well interventions and workovers, and possibly infield drilling that could help augment or that would enable us to process gas beyond this December 2020. And as a first phase, and then an exploration work program can then follow thereafter. So Rosgeo have raised the issue of they are worried that the market that they had envisaged in the form of the gas to liquids refinery may no longer be there if we run out of gas in December 2020. Therefore, they would like to ensure that market remains there. As a result, they are looking at modifying their proposal in a manner that could help optimize current production until we get to a point where you do exploration drilling for additional feedstock supply. Okay, then there's a question. There's a question around Rosgeo is expecting a gas price of $7 per million BTU when gas can be bought at $2.5 US dollars per million BTU to $3 elsewhere. Those prices, firstly, we have been very firm ourselves in the negotiations in terms of a gas price until we were finding one another around this stated price here. But the gas price, there are various components in terms of a gas price. You might buy gas in America if you are based in the US at $2.5 per million BTU. But that is not necessarily the price you will be paying for the same gas that is coming from America when it arrives in South Africa, because there will be the cost of transportation of that gas and liquefaction and so on to get it to LNG, which are a significant cost added onto the cost if you assumed you were in the US. Okay, then there's a question on what's the cost of decommissioning. The cost of decommissioning, we've stated several times in this committee, is 9.8 billion rands. And we've also stated that we've set aside about 2.4 billion and we have a shortfall of 7.4 billion. In terms of how that will be funded, we are earning interest in terms of the 2.4 billion that is currently set aside for decommissioning. But also, if we succeed in terms of a turnaround strategy that enables PetroSA to ramp up production to a 3x3, we will be able to generate the revenues that will enable us to set aside additional funding, but we are also looking, we'll be looking at other potential funding mechanisms in terms of the decommissioning liability. Yeah, so it's a mouthful on, okay. Then there was a question on, okay, why is Ross Geo preferred? This is Honorable Phillips, preferred compared to an indigenous Nigerian company. I guess in the main, it is because they were not able to demonstrate financial capability. One of the criteria we needed, companies with technical depth, but also financial muscle, but they were supposed to demonstrate where that funding would come from. They fell short in that regard. The other company, Solihull's. Okay, so there was a question on do we envisage skills development and transfer in terms of this deal? Yes, we do. And Ross Geo, 3 years ago already, we're very keen in terms of beginning a process of skills development and transfer. So it is something that is inherent in this deal, that we will be working together as a joint venture partnership, and skills will be transferred to South Africans. Okay, then there was a question on who appointed EY, Petro SA or Ross Geo. It was Petro SA who appointed EY to support the farm out process, which was a Petro SA process. The potential partnership with Ross Geo is something that came after Petro SA had gone out to look for potential partners using EY as a transactional advisor. So it is Petro SA that appointed EY. We appointed EY because they have the experience and know-how in terms of farm-out processes. A farm-out process is at the core of the international upstream business, of which there is very limited knowledge in South Africa in terms of the international oil and gas business at this point in time. Thank you, Chair. I think I have covered in the main the bulk of the questions related to Ross Geo.
Mr. Mwahi, we've made comments on the questions that are related to South Sudan and also the conflict and security of our investment there.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just go through all the questions, Chair. If I miss something, we'll come back to it. The first question was related to, you know, previously we had not mentioned that we're 6 days late. Honorable Member, actually we did. I mean, I think in one of the portfolio committee meetings, we mentioned that the project plan came up long before we knew the date of the elections. And at that time, our project plan was that we will sign the IPSA as one of the milestones by the 30th of April. Hence, the group CEO was saying, on the 6th of May, we were 6 days late. There was a question around diversification of source of supply of crude. It is correct, Honorable Member. I mean, you may remember that, you know, in the past, oil used to come from the North and Northwest Europe. These days, we've got a lot of oil reserves in Africa, and we have been engaging with different countries in the region to look at source of supply. And just for the members' information, Honorable Chair, currently, PetroSA is running condensates, the condensates come from Equatorial Guinea and Nigeria, so which actually shows that engaging the countries in the region is helpful. And just for information, honorable members and the chair, the PetroSA is now currently looking at testing condensates or light crude coming out of South Sudan. There is a blend called Nile Blend, which is a grade from South Sudan. The technical people want to test that grade. So it makes sense, actually, to engage with countries in the region to look at them, not only for strategic stock or security of supply. And there was a question around who will own the pipeline and the refinery. I wasn't sure whether Honorable is related to the South African one or the South Sudanese one. But if it's South Sudanese one, just so that we pick it up, we are now at pre-feasibility stage for both projects. And when the pre-feasibility feasibility is done, we'll build a business case. And obviously on the basis of the business case, we'll invite partners. The projects of this magnitude, by their nature, people tend to partner so that not a single entity is exposed to the risk of financial risk. Honorable Member asked a question about the timing of the agreement. I think I dealt with that. The Frosta Ayuk, on the 6th of May when we signed the contract was signed between SFF and the Ministry of Petroleum of South Sudan. People who were there, none of them actually got involved in the signing of the project, of the agreement. The then minister was in a rush. I think we'll touch on that. I mean, I think there was no, there's always a project plan. And I think if you miss your target on the project plan, you run in the risk of not being able to deliver other things. So the project plan was always the 6th of April, and we couldn't do it on time. And I think my colleague earlier on mentioned that this project had nothing, not everything to do with the previous minister, because this project was started in 2014, 2015. So it has been ongoing for a long time. Why would SFF be the one who is signing this agreement? Honorable members, if you, just that I don't have a copy here, but according to SFF MOI, SFF can get involved in the exploration and production. That's the reason for SFF being. It is the group and the ministry's decision to actually decide who gets involved in this project. And in this case, there was a ministerial directive to say SFF should actually deal with this project. What will be the benefit for South African businesses? We've been very conscious of the fact that, with all this project, not only this one, but across the group, we need to encourage South African businesses to participate, and in this case, South Sudanese businesses. Recently, there was a tender that went out, for the work in South Sudan, and we had some South African businesses either in partnership or on their own, put in the bid. At this stage, I don't know the outcome of the bid, but they participated in tendering. And we'll encourage South African businesses to actually look at the activities in South Sudan, including some of our SOEs. I mean, we've been talking to them about what we are doing there. And I've just wondered in case they got interest. And then, Chair, there was a question around a pipeline that passed through Sudan. What we raised last time was the fact that the cost of evacuating crude through North Sudan is very high, and we're looking at alternative evacuation routes, and we're looking at the pipeline going south instead of going north. We have not engaged the North Sudan yet because at this stage we do not have crude that we're evacuating. But we're looking at alternative exit routes to actually optimize the logistics and make sure that we save the money. So, Honorable Member, we're going to be working hard to make sure that even if you save $2 per barrel, that's a lot of money. One of the things that we're focusing on is to squeeze as much juice as we can out of this. Honorable Mellon, the issue on IPSA, maybe let's just me clarify what I said. I mean, Honorable Chair, I'm also from the rural area, so maybe my English was not very clear. So what I said at the time is we have received the letter,
and I said we will revert in 30 days. I did not say I will deliver the agreement to the Honorable in 30 days. I said we'll revert in 30 days. On the 25th of October, I addressed a letter to Honorable Member, and if you have not received it, Honorable Member, I apologize, and I'll make sure that when I get back to the office, I send it back to you. The letter went to your Gmail address. When we leave here, we'll exchange Gmail address, and then I'll make sure it gets to you today. But I did reply, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member, on the 25th. I wouldn't have missed that, Honorable Member, because you wanted me to reply on that. Why Petrovision? I think one of the things that we really focus on, Honorable Member, is one, while we are creating opportunities for companies to participate, we also need to look at the magnitude of this investment and make sure that we get people who have been around the block and back and who understand this business. Petrovision has been working with a lot of multinationals on this. Actually, if you remember, the Gulf of Mexico disaster, Petrovision handled that. So purely on the basis of their competency and capacity, we engaged Petrovision to help us to estimate the value, because we also wanted to make sure that at least it's positive before we can take the next step. The value, Honorable Member, at this stage we can't say exactly, but from that evaluation, the estimation is between $1 and $2 billion. The conflict in South Sudan, I mean, we are working, how safe is our investment? Honorable Member, I think what we try to do is do our best in terms of risk assessment and managing risk. The good thing is we are in partnership with the South Sudanese National Oil Company. The Ministry of Petroleum is working very closely with us. We are looking at doing the magnetic surveys during this dry season. And the Ministry of Petroleum have agreed that they will be going to the states, in different states, and engaging the leaders in those states to make sure that they understand that we will be flying there. But we're not putting the assets on the ground yet. You know, we are still at a steady stage. And, you know, as we progress, we'll continue to do risk assessment. You know, we can always hold back if we feel that the situation is too risky. But at this stage, we have not seen anything that suggests that. As Honorable Member mentioned, there is a discussion around government of national unity, which actually talks to the peace that the South Sudanese have signed. Assurance of our investors' investment, I think I touched on that, Honorable Member. Then the government of national unity, I also touched on that. Yeah, the South Sudanese have signed the government of national unity. It has been it has been postponed. It was supposed to be the 12th of last month, and those discussions continue to happen. And we watch them very closely. The other thing that we do, Honorable Member, when we go to South Sudan, we engage our embassy, we engage our people on the ground to get feedback. So we don't only rely on the South Sudanese, we also rely on South Africans who are on the ground, you know, and they give us guidance where it's necessary. And then there was a question around electric cars that I don't know if CEO have not touched on it. I can attempt. The issue of electric cars is actually something that impacts on this industry globally. But, you know, when you look at the projection in terms of the energy demand, the hydrocarbon demand will continue to grow for the next 20 to 30 years. And only at that point, after 30 years, then it will plateau, but the demand will still be there, and the growth will then be eaten by electric cars. So we still have a long way, you know, to go to actually engage in hydrocarbon. So we are very conscious of that, and I think as we look at this investment, we continue to look at the timeline and look at the investment and the investment returns to make sure that we continue to recoup our investment. I think, Chair, if I didn't miss any question, I'll hand to the Group CEO. I think I've covered some of the questions. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair of the CONMPT and members. I will predominantly cover the areas pertaining to the new refinery. The colleagues have covered both the Petroceros Geo and the opportunity for South Sudan. The question was around who would own this. In terms of the MOC that we have, this is a joint development. As we are looking at it for now, we are looking at joint ownership. Some of the details in terms of the equity and all of that, once the business case has been determined and firmed, those would be made available to the committee by the Honourable Minister. So in terms of where we are now, it is a joint development and joint ownership, and so there is work to finalise that. The other question was around the impact on how would the forestry industry be compensated. If we look at the area that has been identified, the trees that are planted in that area would be harvested in the next 3 to 4 years. And the Richards Bay IDZ has identified a alternative location where forestry will continue. So that is taken care of. I think let me combine this with all the related environmental questions. When you design the refinery, we would move from pre-feasibility to feasibility before we go to FEED. What we'd be doing is, in pre-feasibility, we are looking at a number of configurations, which technologies. In feasibility, we choose a particular technology that will maximize the value. Thereafter, during feasibility, we then say you need to do an environmental impact assessment. Currently in the country, you currently have environmental laws. We have the new emission laws. We have the carbon tax and other related environmental laws. That will do an environmental assessment in the feasibility phase, which will start sometime next year. And this is before you do a detailed EIA that involves the public. So that you then say, these are all the environmental laws. How do they affect my design? And how do I ensure I engineer out so that I do not impact the environment negatively? So at this phase of where we are, this is not what we are doing to be done once you've selected the configuration and the technology. And all of those things will be taken into account. We are designing a refinery cognizant of all the other international treaties that South Africa has signed with respect of protecting the environment, also sensitive to the global warming. So the final design that will be looked at when we do feasibility and later on FEED will take into account all the relevant environmental regulations and all the treaties that South Africa signed. And that is why we are designing a refinery that will be Euro 5 so that it produces even product that meets the environmental regulation. So it is not just on the manufacturing. Even what we'll be producing will be something that meets all the environmental regulations. So this is taken care in terms of ensuring that we produce the clean fuels that meets the specifications. That is why even on the issues, for example, of how would you deal with issues of your utilities. Those are something that will be taken into account so that we take into cognizance. For example, in the refinery, you can take some of your streams and begin to generate from your utility streams electricity and have green energy. So those things will be taken into account when we go to the details of feasibility. I think, Chair and the committee, when you are selecting and you're looking at more than 200 technologies, you can't go into that detail at this phase, and it is not something for pre-feasibility that we're looking at. Yet, when we've chosen the configuration, then we go to the details of those things in feasibility and FEED. So for where we are committed to build a refinery
that meets all the specification and that is environmentally friendly. So just to combine those. The other related question on the new refinery is the other international oil companies are not investing. Why is there no appetite? Is it perhaps of demand? Is it perhaps of no appetite? Is it perhaps of policy and regulation certainty? Can I add the fourth one? Is it perhaps their strategy? Because if you operate an entity, each entity develops its own strategy. We have seen over the past 5 to 10 years, some IOCs moving away from downstream, just focusing on upstream. And therefore, from where I am, I'm not qualified to comment why did they change strategy to move from downstream and go to upstream. We have seen international, except in South Africa, where the IOCs have moved from downstream and diversified and focused on upstream. And the interesting question is, why have we not seen that trend in South Africa? Yet internationally, this is what the IOCs have done. Chair and honorable members, I'm not qualified to discuss the strategy of IOC except to observe that there is something interesting that they seem to want to hold on in the downstream in the country. Secondly, if you must do an investment to meet environmental regulations, stringent environmental regulation, that type of an investment does not have returns because you are not investing to improve the margin. You are investing to meet the regulations. That is why if you go back even prior to 2017, there was a debate in the country where IOCs were saying government needs to have a way of funding the introduction of CF2 so that the investments they will be making there can be cost recovery. That is why there's been a delay in the introduction of CF2 in the country, which was supposed to have been done in 2017. It's because private sector is saying, why should I invest to meet clean fuels? Why should I invest for environmental reasons? Why should I invest for health reasons? Yet, you are the one regulating, and that's a debate I'd allow the department to really pronounce on that. But that is why there's been a delay in the introduction of clean fuels too into the country. We are not being careless. We are ensuring as a country we would make an investment that will increase the manufacturing capability of the country and produce fuel that is clean, meets the environmental regulations, and does not expose South Africans to any health issues. That is the commitment we are making with regard to this investment. I think the other question the DG has responded to around Transnet, I need to place it on record, Chair, that as the SEF group, we are engaging with Transnet around the refinery in Richards Bay. And as I said earlier on, in the very near future, we will be signing a joint study agreement because some of the work we need to do in Richards Bay on the new refinery, we will be working with them. Similarly, we will be working with them on the LNG project in Kuga. So from where I've met the CEO, we are engaging, and there's not something that I think Transnet, from where we are, has indicated otherwise. But as I think my chairperson did indicate earlier on, and the DG, the Transnet is better placed to comment on that. But what we know as CEOs and chief operating officers, we are working on having a joint study agreement around the support and that we require from Transnet on the new refinery and also on the work that we are doing on LNG. The last comment, Chair, was what I'm going to do differently. Chair and the committee, the minister announced in his budget speech the building of the new refinery in Richards Bay. The minister announced the LNG in Kuga. We are saying to the committee, by end of December, we would have completed the pre-feasibility. That shows that there is a drive to implement and execute. Which means there are beginning to be fruits. And what we are also doing is to ensure that we have dedicated teams. Let's use, for example, the South Sudan project. we've moved away from operating in silos. We are not saying the South Sudan is an SFF project. We are saying it is a project that SFF does on behalf of the group, where there are skills at PetroSA, where there are skills at IGES, we leverage on those so that we deliver, instead of one entity just driving. This is something that we are doing differently. The minister, the chairman of the board, has been very hard at saying we need, our strategy now should be about execution and executing, not just planning, and therefore we are leveraging on the skills. That is why, ordinarily, the South Sudan project, that negotiations, ordinarily, if we look at our track record, it would have taken us 18 months or 2 years to negotiate. Yes, we are 6 days late, but it is an improvement because there is a drive to build a new culture of executing, and the board is very hard on that, and the minister to say, to ensure we deliver. I think, thank you, Chair, this is where I will end on the matter.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I think...
If I may, Chair, Mr. Mwahi responded on Petrovision. We were looking for an entity with experience and track record that will be able to give a very informed technical and commercial advice after a competitive process. He did respond to that. Mr. Saidini responded to also to YEY. So those were responded to by them, Chair. Thank you.
Sure, wait, Ola. Oh, Chair.
Yeah, I was saying we're done, and some of the things regarding the PetroSA and especially the turnaround strategy that has really been holding on the compact plan is something that we're working very hard on it, and sometime in the first quarter we hope we'll be able to give the turnaround strategy for PetroSA and beyond the December 2020. Thank you.
Okay. Honourable Member, the time is 1:15. We are up until 1 o'clock to be in this room. We are supposed to deal with minutes, which I think we have to put in abeyance. I'm very reluctant to give follow-ups that may take us to 2 o'clock when the bells are ringing, except to say, one, the DGs, both of them that are here, let me say one first issue. We are coming back next year. Probably you would have been one consolidated department and an operational entities. And as you do so, we expect your annual performance, your budget proposals, and your targets. And as there was this discussion and reading the report, and I was starting to look in between and say some of the issues here might have financial implications. And I hope as you prepare for the next financial year, there will be a way of accommodating these issues. I must leave because there were many issues. I postponed them. Chair of SWEF, I postponed them as a generous chairperson for next year when you are well versed. Very prepared not to postpone anything, but postpone everything to yourself, because you will be having clarity of the entity, the entities, and the entity in charge of. So I'm sure by that time we will have dealt with the issues, but
I think some of the questions I want to, for instance, there is still to me a lot that we need to discuss in terms, just to give you a clarity on page 39. I understand what Honorable Milam was saying, but I might have had a different understanding of what is being raised there. In terms of, because it says capital commitment for the exploration phase will be funded from internal cash resources. You see? But it then says, when it follows, it says total exposure for the 6-year exploration phase in US dollars is $48 million. Then it breaks it in almost into two. It says exit position could be triggered in year 4 with a total financial exposure to SFF of $31 million. So in year 4, from 48 in year 4, estimated projection, that's why I said we need to look at those things. Then it says estimated year-on-year commitment is $8 million per annum, US dollars. Now, I'm saying some of those things we'll be expecting, because part of the experience some of us have is that when the budget is made, some of these don't reflect. And then down the line, they emerge somewhere else. So I was very interested one has got a very interest on that area. I'm just saying for future purposes. Now if you go again on page 43, if we have time, because there is a bigger question again, and I don't want to say let's whether we sit here and fight whether there is a refinery or in PE or a refinery in Richards Bay, I guess it's a project, but we have an interest. It's a project. In fact, I was saying to the secretaries, it might be difficult to talk about the project that we have got no sense of feeling. Maybe it could be something, one, that the committee must consider. And I was always sitting here, I was thinking of 15 kilometers from Richards Bay, with my knowledge. Now, the problem with a place, when they say 15 kilometers, Mark, at least Suvenda, when they say 15 kilometers from a place, they come from the city hall, which is the city center. Now, for me, I will count 15 kilometers outside of Richards Bay. And then that becomes Umbonambi. You see? And I don't think Umbonambi falls under Richards Bay. So I'm just saying, physically, we might have an interest to see what are we actually talking about. When you say you move a forest, I've never seen Babuzo on a forest being moved. The forest is a forest. It just sticks there. To take the forest and say we'll take the forest and put it somewhere else, it may be something that, but I know RBM has done a very good job, but it's rehabilitation. It's not a movement of a forest. It's a rehabilitation of a plantation that would have been there. But if I remember correctly, while the minister, which is why sometimes I don't want things, if I understood correctly, the initial submission from him was that the investor is the South Arabian. And when the investor says, this is where I want to put my business, then it will be difficult as the government to say, no, you can't put your plant here, you must take it somewhere else. And the issue we raised was that could be correct. You can't put a condition of where I must invest my money by location. You can only impose or talk about the conditions of investment that any investor has to comply with within the South African laws. That is the only... So I'm just saying we have to get finally on this issue that who takes liability, because I see the reason I'm saying it says at the end there on page 43, estimated capital cost for refinery only is $10 billion. So I assume the Saudi Arabians will pay the $10 million, so that tomorrow we don't come back here and argue about who took this thing. So this one, Babuzon, please, again, I take it, it's still a work in progress. This forest is not a forest that stands. Maybe you could have, I'm not going to give you now time to respond. It says currently in Sapi forest land. So it's a privately owned land. The question could what would arise is it a land, and it's not for us anyway, it's maybe it's a refinery, but surely we'll be also contributing in terms of making sure that it becomes a successful investment. Is the question would be, is there a contract or a sale agreement between SAPI and those who want to put a refinery? Because it's not saying it's a municipal land, it says it's a SAPI forestry land, which then makes me take to go. So I'm saying we need to have a much more better comprehensive exercise. The last issue which I thought is your timeline. I looked at them. It means by next month, for now, your timelines are done. I accept two things. You see, Chair of Self, when you are starting to count your days, those timelines would have been finished. I'm not sure how much capacity would you have to reverse them. And with the appointment of the CEO, I don't know, because the acting CEO of, I'm not saying he's wrong, the acting CEO of Petro SA says the turnover of ministers have made things not easy in terms of the delays. I fear when we come here next time, we get a report that the new appointment of CEOs has not assisted us because they needed to be reorientated on this project. And I can't sit here and say, please appoint. But I'm saying when these people come next time, it's going to be, I'll be honest, it's going to be very difficult to convince us that what is being proposed as budget, as annual targets, as annual performances, are things that we can easily approve. So because I argued last time, I said, even if you were to take all of us as politicians, bureaucrats can still run government. It has been proven. So where the minister says they've got that, the last thing that I think we have to clarify to us, and this is where the weaknesses of public service again, and with due respect to my colleagues from my own revolutionary party, sometimes the working in silos may not assist us. I thought some of these trade agreements are supposed to form part of DTI, as an example, are supposed to form part of the international relations. Now, sometimes I feel that when he says the turnover of ministers, the big question is that were those things not reported and approved at cabinet level, why do you have to wait for a new minister who's coming in? I know, even if you put me, if I were to have that luck to be a minister, I would want to exercise the authority that, wait, you can't go over. But my question would be, can't you go and consider a better mechanism that, for instance, Grand Inga is not only for the Department of Energy then, nor now a matter for the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy.
that it finds a way to be elevated to a point where it exactly talks to a government to government. Because now it seems to me, more than being a government to government, it is a department to a department on the other side. Mm. So you need to find when we deal with those issues to bring those matters. So I'm just flagging these things because I thought that they are important for future references, that when we deal with them, we deal with them from a point of trying to assist the smooth running, that even if you appoint any other person at a political level, it cannot be a matter that hamstrung the processes. But having said so, Honorable Mashaul, I thought, is it really, really extremely, extremely urgent that you will hate me or you will have that anger towards me that I close this meeting before you speak? Okay.
Chair, I just want to start where you ended off. In terms of in the near future, how we must operate. I don't think it was correct what was happening between Mr. Moahi and Honorable Malam, that if a member of a committee asks for a document, that document must be sent to that particular member, not members of the committee or the committee itself. Because once you speak and request the DG to bring something, you are not speaking on your behalf, you are speaking on behalf of the committee. That document must come to the committee, and not to the person who is asking for it. It would be wrong for them to exchange the Gmail and send each other that document because that document was asked on behalf of the committee. I just wanted to make that point, Chair.
Now, can we deal with this as a matter of procedure? I kept quiet myself. The point is, for me, what happens outside the point is there was a correspondence sent to Mr. Moahi. Now that correspondence or exchange arises in the committee, which makes matter now a little bit complex, because if it is raised, and I must say this thing, I always say, if a matter is raised in the committee, once members of the committee keep quiet, let's just start there, keep quiet, not object, not say anything, then you must know it becomes a committee decision. It won't change, you see. Now, I don't want, my dilemma though is that at this stage there was no request from the committee for such an information. But what has happened is that the matter has been raised in the committee. Now, the committee has not said it disowns the matter, so that the matter becomes, I don't think there's something wrong if it's between Mr. Moah and Honorable Mylet. There's nothing wrong. But if it is raised in the committee, that's where the matter, because if now if Mr. Moah says, "Oh, Honorable Mylet, I will give you this thing," it means the committee commits to that. But can I make this proposal so that we can all be at the same level? There's nothing wrong to write to send the letter you sent to Honorable Mylem, but can you send the letter, because it's official now, it's in the committee, can you send the response through the normal channels of communicating with the committee? That's point one. But point two, let me say again this thing, so that last time, and I must say again with extremely sensitivity, last time with a very heated argument around the turnaround strategy, and I'm saying this thing with extreme caution not to take the meeting back, around the turnaround strategy of SAF and Petro SA, when the late Deputy Minister, may her soul rest in peace, raised the matter to say, regrettable, I can't own what is in front of the committee. Now, I'm just saying this because it's only to an entity under SAF that the risk is that, I don't know, that's why I said I don't know the answer, I don't know what it is. But I'm very careful of one thing, that SAF does not come here and say, I don't know what you are talking about, because it was never with us. Then the department, including the minister, says the same thing. But all what I'm saying is that for the sake of this committee, if that matter is raised, can we have, we will decide what then becomes the course of action in dealing with it. The last issue, honorable members, I wanted to say, I see many things now being referred. No, there is something else now that is coming here. We won't deal with the minutes now. We'll deal with them next time. We were supposed tomorrow to deal with, that's what I said, the issue of the private members' bill. Unfortunately, as we were interacting, we are hamstrung by procedures of Parliament. What, when this thing bill comes, this is what you need to do. We then realized after the meeting that some of the issues were not properly followed. And we have agreed now that through the guidance both of the committee secretary and the through also themselves consulting with parliamentary legal service, so that we follow exactly the correct procedure in dealing with a bill of parliament. Because one of the things that you can do in a bill of parliament is a simple exercise. You can run through all the good contents and everything. Then somebody just take the rules book and say, yes, you did everything, but not according to the rules. So we are trying now to do exactly to follow the rules, and hopefully with the process that we are going to follow, we will only be dealing with that next week. We are trying our level best. In terms of the private members' bill that we have suggested, that is the projection that we are having. Tomorrow we are meeting again, ne? For derelict and ownerless mines. That's what we'll be dealing with. So tomorrow we are meeting. You'll get the notice on derelict and ownerless mines. Thank you very much.